welcome, welcome, welcome to another exciting. I like saying things in threes.
You need to do it like a welcome, welcome, welcome to the one-up truck and tractor pool. Sunday.
The kings of crash, the demons of dirt. You pay for the whole seat, but all you really need is the edge.
Exactly.
I like that. I think that's good.
I think that's how you need to intro this show from now on.
So this is episode 4 of Four Guys One Up for November 20th, 2009. It's the first time I've mentioned the date on the podcast, mostly because it's my
now we're preserved for posterity.
It's my birthday, so I'm going to wish myself a happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Congratulations on getting older.
I know. It's actually interesting.
You're catching up with me, young'un.
It's about 6 weeks ago I realized I thought I was a year older than I am the entire year. Because I was born in 81, but my birthday is not until November.
How old are you?
I'll be 28 when this goes out.
See, once you hit 30, you stop counting, kind of.
I kind of don't care at this point, because I feel like I'm 38 or something. I feel old, but whatever. So, welcome to the podcast. You've already heard two of our guests this week, which, of course, is now regular, Jeremy Parrish.
Am I?
Thank you for coming.
Well, yeah. My doctor will be happy to hear that.
You're here.
Now that I'm all old.
And you probably recognize another friend of the show, Mr. Christian Nutt from Gamasutra.
Hello, hello.
Who was very kind enough to join us, but someone who deserves the most credit for joining us. You haven't heard her voice yet. She's joining us just to prove that four guys doesn't necessarily mean you have to be male. Joining us on the podcast tonight is Alice Liang.
I was actually going to try to talk in like a low voice all night long.
Wait,
I
can actually boost your low, so if you want to...
Oh, it doesn't make me sound
actually,
really funny.
Actually, can you go into GarageBand and slow down everything she says?
Hey, guys.
I'm going to talk slow.
But, Alice, I really do thank you for coming on. Today was kind of a disaster scheduling-wise. Scooter came down sick. He was going to be on. And
yeah, sorry about that.
Then last sec... yeah, Jeremy.
Apparently he...
We've narrowed it down. We think Jeremy is patient zero.
I am patient zero.
Yeah, well, stop spitting on people's food and they wouldn't get sick.
Oh, I can't help it. The food just needed to be spit on. It insulted my mother.
It looked really dry. But also, Sam Kennedy was unable to join us as well. But so literally 15 minutes before recording, I walked in Alice's office, closed the door, and said, "Hey, Alice, I got a favor to ask. Can you come on the podcast?" And of course she did, so I definitely appreciate that. So this show is going to be a little interesting. We were unable to get kind of our traditional, or not really traditional, we're only four episodes in, non-editorial guest on the show this week, but Christian was kind enough to join us, and Gamasutra is not traditional games editorial anyway, so
no, it's actually good games editorial. Yep. It's very non-traditional.
Yeah, but they also focus on more of the business aspect and
business
kind
and
of the design. Yeah, the developer side of things. So so in lieu of the kind of normal, what we've kind of been doing with a segment focused on the guest and the news and what you've been playing, we're going to just basically focus on two segments, which is news and what you've been playing. Of course, there's been some very interesting stories this week. The one that definitely dominated most of the coverage earlier in the week is the story that was originally broken by Kotaku earlier this week that if EA closing Pandemic Studio, and I have the printout here, is all based on a memo that was eventually released. Gamasutra had a write-up on it, and Kotaku also had a post about it, is that basically Electronic Arts is closing down Pandemic Studios, laying off 200 employees. They are keeping what they're calling a core IP team, which is being moved to the Electronic Arts Los Angeles office. Among those let go were the studio's top three employees, which included Andrew Goldman, formerly the studio's CEO, Josh Resnick, formerly the studio's president, and Greg Borad, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, vice president of product development. One of the talking points early on is that although they've sacked 200 employees from the company, they are going to keep the Pandemic brand, and the franchises are going to live on, from a quote from Nick Earle, who is the EA Games label senior vice president. They said they still plan to announce new games in the Pandemic franchise. Obviously, this move, although a surprise in the timing, not necessarily a shock that it eventually happened. Pandemic's last few releases have been, they haven't been well received both critically and from a sales perspective.
And yeah, importantly, you have to think about this. EA is losing money, and when you look at the cost of operating Pandemic, and then the cost of, you know, Saboteur took what, like more than 4 years?
Yeah. Has it really been in the works that long?
Yeah, from pre-production,
really the first I'd ever seen of it or heard of it was at E3 this year.
Full production, 3 years. Wow. Pre-production with four.
Yeah. That's a lot of money.
LOTR, which was, you know, not a great game, and Mercs 2 was sort of embarrassing. I mean, not to be mean to anyone who works Pandemic, and I know from talking to people that work there that people mostly were well aware. You know, developers who make games that have problems usually aren't like in denial about the problems their games have. Yeah. Mercs 2 was not a triumph. Let's put it like that. It was a long development. That was another really long, expensive development, and they ended up shipping a game that was fundamentally not that much better than the prior generation version.
I mean, it really was. It really was a last-generation game thrown with, like, a coat of paint that was kind of shoved out the door.
Which would have been
fine. At least perspective-wise, obviously, there was a lot more work than that put into it.
Well, it's like, if they had done that in 18 months, that would have been one thing, but that's another four-year project that cost, you know, millions and ended up, you know.
Yeah, and as we know, every time a game is pushed back, they have a whole new set of P&Ls, profit and loss, that comes into that, and that, you know, drags the entire studio down, and obviously, you know, they had the very costly problem of, you know, the Australian gambit of their studio with the Dark Knight game that was canceled, a lot of money was sunk into that.
When they closed the Australian Pandemic last year.
Yeah, which I really should have been like step one of, you know, post that. I mean, you had the Mercs release was after that, or right around the same time.
I can't quite recall.
There's been talk here in the office with different people of the inevitability of Pandemic going away, because there has been a lot of concern about the quality of their games and just, you know, bad luck they've had. Like you said, the Australia studio shutting down. So this news was, I mean, even though I don't really follow the company, this news wasn't surprising just because there's been kind of this sense of, I don't know if I'd call it foreboding, but just kind of inevitability that things weren't going well for the company.
And with Saboteur coming out, you know, a few weeks from now, the game's done.
I think the phrase you're looking for is being sent to die.
Yes. I mean, that's the phrase we have. You actually, Christian, you posted earlier this week on Twitter a quote from NeoGAF, from a poster named Seenbor, who is apparently an employee of Pandemic. And he has some very interesting quotes from it. Just a few. I can tell you one thing. The reason why the studio closed down has everything to do with the existing Pandemic management. Time and time again, they drop the ball with bad decisions, promoting, keeping people based on loyalty, no production accountability, misallocation of resources, poor milestone objectives, no mentoring, etc. It's a true shame, as there was a lot of talent and passion at the studio. And he goes on to say he doesn't necessarily think that you should hate on JR, who was one of the original founders of Pandemic.
I think he means John Riccitello, actually.
Oh, yeah, you're right. John,
I know,
Riccitello.
It could be Josh Resnick, but
yeah,
I think
but in this
John
context,
Riccitello,
you're right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And EA's execs.
In my eyes, they probably made the right decision, as Pandemic costs a lot to upkeep. And he goes on to talk about the cost associated with Saboteur. Think employing 100 people for 3 years plus 20 people for 2 years. And he goes on to say, add overhead costs to incompetence in management direction, and you have a pretty convincing case to cut your ties and call it a day. Clearly, that's someone who definitely is in the heat of the moment of everything going down, and obviously have some very strong thoughts about the way he felt that the company was being run.
I mean, this is something I didn't, you know, it's one of these things are really tough, and I feel really bad for people, you know. I mean, I was talking about with one of my friends, a developer, that this is one of the biggest layoffs and studio closures in the history of video games. 200 people lost their jobs. And so you have a lot of sympathy, but then you kind of want to talk about why these things happened. And I'm glad to see someone from the studio coming out and saying some of this stuff, because it makes it a lot easier to feel comfortable saying it, which is the studio had problems. And you know, I think that one of the reasons studios enter into transactions, sell themselves, is obviously payouts for the founders. But another major reason is because they're seeking stability, the kind of stability that, you know, large publishers can provide in terms of things like testing, distribution, marketing, et cetera, those functions which EA has and that they don't. But the problem is that either, you know, it's a possibility that EA couldn't provide the level of stability that Pandemic required. Pandemic, if it was really a problem child, maybe was too problematic for EA to really work with. But also, EA is not that stable right now.
Right.
So, you know, if EA were in the kind of like Activision style position, you know, where they had like all that World of Warcraft money rolling in.
And now COD money.
Right. Then like that might be one thing. But EA hasn't been in that position for a while. And suddenly, you know, they have to make these decisions. And it's not cheap to wind down a studio, and they have the Westwood offices. I've been there for Pandemic, which they have to close now, are beautiful, and you know, there's a lot of sunk costs in terms of like equipment and
right.
training, and now they have to cut all these people free. The silver lining I'm hoping for is, and I've already heard some rumblings about this, is a lot of people in LA are going to start their own teams and projects and really push forward on some cool stuff. So there's, I mean, it's not a silver lining for people who lost their jobs right before the holiday.
Right.
But it is potentially a silver lining for games, right?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately with pandemic, you have a situation where it was a company that was formed out of, it wasn't originally formed as an Activision, associated with Activision. It originally,
I can't recall.
Its first few games, I believe, were sequels to Activision games. I can't remember what they were off the top of my head. But then eventually, you know, they were able to form some of their own IPs, also working with established IPs with Star Wars Battlefront.
Well, it was an interesting evolution because, you know, they originally started as, yeah, they were doing stuff like Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
and that was a big hit. And then they decided to, there was that period where they were like, you know, if you remember, the original Mercs was an EA Partners game.
Right.
It was they developed that game under their own power. They developed that game and they got far, far along, and then they got a publisher and it was EA, but it wasn't.
It was also a company that was doing things that no one else was really doing at the time. I mean, if you look at a game like Full Spectrum Warrior, it was almost kind of a very interesting hybrid, almost RTS experience. Obviously, the sequel wasn't necessarily a big hit or anything like that, but the original game, I remember playing it and enjoying it very much because it was just so unlike anything else on consoles at that point. But it was also a studio that was built into making games for last generation, the Xbox One, PS2, and it seems, at least on the surface, from the outside, it seems like they had a very difficult time, as a lot of studios have had, transitioning to this generation with the incredible increase in costs associated with producing games for high-definition consoles.
You know, you hear a lot about that on the Japanese side of the industry, but you don't really hear a lot about that coming here in the U.S. Like, everyone just kind of takes it as a measure of faith that American developers have just magically been able to make that jump. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, whereas people shake their finger and say, oh, Japan, you don't get it. But clearly,
no, it happened here.
It's happened here, but you don't hear much about it. It's just, yeah. Like, there's kind of tacit understanding.
Happened.
But, yeah, I mean, this is kind of proof that, yeah, this is a tough transition for everyone all around.
Well, and I think an interesting aside to this story is the fact that Riccatello was with the company, the VG Holding Group, when EA acquired it. So obviously there probably has to be some internal pressures for him personally to kind of, for probably a long time, for this studio to perform because,
Well, the honeymoon's got to be over, right?
That acquisition was one of the first that was anything approaching $800 million for BioWare and Pandemic. Obviously, BioWare has, you know, that portion of the acquisition has been successful up to this point. But when you have half the acquisition, it really hasn't kind of earned its keep.
Well, it's what it is that, you know, we all, I think, as the press, got very excited about John Riccatello because he talked the talk we wanted to hear.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that he was being disingenuous. I think he's very honest.
Mm-hmm.
And saying that, you know, we have to develop these games. They have to be better. We have to be more creative. We have to, you know, revitalize EA. We have to take it away from that place where it was.
Yeah.
But it hasn't played out financially for them, and they're a public company. And with something like this happening, it's going to be some sort of reckoning is in the cards.
Yeah, I mean, especially...
Well, I was just going to say, I was kind of curious about the timing. Do you know when Saboteur was actually finished development-wise?
It was very shortly after it finished certification.
Yeah, no, this happened like the second they got done.
But Saboteur itself has had a lot of trouble. I mean, obviously, it's not unheard of in development circles, but it failed alpha certification internally at EA.
Mm.
I know that for a fact. And so, obviously, that's not any indication of the current quality of the game.
What does that mean exactly, just in layman's terms?
Yeah, you have the QA department. You have – basically, they do a kind of a – it's kind of the mock review stuff or alpha early on, and it did not perform to the marks that were set for it, which does happen. It's certainly not uncommon. It's probably more common than people realize. But – obviously, with a studio like Pandemic, probably had people looking at it even tighter internally at EA than you would otherwise. It obviously, probably put off some flags.
To get back to this post by Zinber, whatever, he does mention at the end that, he says that EA is sending Saboteur out to die, but he also claims that it's... In his perspective, he thinks it's one of Pandemic's best games ever.
Well, yeah, I mean, so. He does say that he was working on it, and it's a game that's demoed very well.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, you've heard things – I've heard people say things like it demos really well, but who knows what the final game is actually going to be like, because we've had experiences like that before where a game will demo fantastically well for a couple of years.
I mean, it has that big open sandbox style. Yeah. So the first thing you think is, oh, well, maybe it's like the first Assassin's Creed. Like,
right.
Great for demos, and then you play it for an extended period. And
Well, that's the thing, right? If they're – like, we're talking about this issue with pandemic sort of – and I think it's – and this isn't a slight against – all I've ever heard about Pandemic from anyone I've ever talked to is there's a huge amount of talent there, and Zinebor definitely bears out that he thinks it's management that was
right.
not being able to leverage that talent and get it to produce. So, again, it does seem that there was a struggle with the platform transition. If you look at it that way, this is essentially the first generation next gen project from them, because if you look at Loader and Mercs 2, they are very like last gen-y.
Right.
So what that means is that if this is like Assassin's Creed 1, it's going to be going up against Assassin's Creed 2 if it's got you know what I mean, like if right. we're it's you know
it's
I mean Square is looking at that problem too. A lot
yeah.
of Japanese companies are looking at this problem where, you know, like Final Fantasy 13 is going up against, you know, it's Square's first major next gen game going up against, you know, like Western companies that are two or three
right.
deep.
Right,
so,
and I mean, you watch the trailer, and there are some parts of the 13 trailer that just came out last week. Where
wait, you mean
like,
the infomercial?
Besides the horrible I'm a Mac guy talking, like parts of the game where you're kind of like, you know, this looks a little like a PS2 game with really nice graphics.
Yeah.
Like, there's just a little bit of that
style.
Awkwardness to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but just kind of the way things work in the game. And I hope that's not really the case, but... But, you know, I can definitely see where that kind of carries over into...
It's not a trivial task getting 100 people, as Zinebor says, 100 people working on the same thing for 3 years is not a trivial thing to make happen. The fact that games are so good is a testament to the talent and drive of the people who make them. But it's not a simple task to keep people on track and manage these kind of huge scale projects that involve a lot of intricacy.
I mean, obviously with a company like EA, you have a scale that most companies can't really imagine. Most game development studios can't imagine. EA announced second fiscal quarter saw losses of $391 million. Obviously the publishers announced that they plan to cut 1500 jobs by April 2010. This is part of that. There's been a lot of stuff out there about,
well, this is why they bought Playfish.
That is an interesting aside, but I mean, we've heard stuff about other studios, internal studios at EA that had layoffs. Black Box, it's all been but confirmed that Black Box had some layoffs at the end of October.
Yeah.
Some very significant people that left Black Box, people that have been there from the beginning, and they've actually moved where Black Box is to share space with another part of EA Studio.
EA Canada.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we think of there were losses. This is what I've heard. I don't remember off the top of my head which ones are like verified publicly and which ones are just I heard, you know, through the grapevine. But we heard about people getting laid off like everywhere. We'd heard Tiburon.
Yeah.
I heard people getting – not. I mean, not. I didn't hear anything about BioWare.
No.
But, you know, I did hear
– especially in lieu of Dragon Age, I think BioWare is doing pretty well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we're just – I think judging from my Twitter, I think – that's doing fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, we don't have NPDs for it yet. But it's like, it's EA has talked about, you know, in this closure, they talk about, and then the general overarching 1500 layoffs through April, which will be probably as people come off projects.
Right.
That they need to leverage direct to consumer, direct digital stuff. And then they're buying Playfish. What they're saying is, look, we can't sell people $60 box games forever. We can't be so reliant on that. And if you look at the way, you know, look at the money that's being made on like Facebook, that's why they bought Playfish, because it's a lot more lean and it's generating revenue.
And I mean, I've actually heard the exact same thing you have. And that's something that's being preached as gospel across to EA of direct to consumer, cutting out retail, because the higher ups there, whether they're right or not, it's open to some interpretation, hold retail specifically responsible for the loss of profits. You know, the whole secondhand games market. I mean, we had a story out this week that GameStop, I think, is up 8.3% year-over-year.
Yeah, the NPDs are down all year, but GameStop's up.
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
I know. I mean, NPDs, I think, what is it? The entire industry is down 13.5%.
It's like 13 year on year.
Yeah, but there is an expectation. I mean, these layoffs, there's a reason they're happening when they are. It's also cost cutting, but it's also going ahead and getting them out of the way, because a lot of people are expecting the industry to turn around next year. There was another report this week, I think, a quote from someone at Sony, might have been, I don't remember who it was, but where they said they expected the video game industry to be up in 2010 year over year compared to this year, which we're for lucky it'll be only down 8%, which I think is what I read in the Gama Sutra.
Yeah. MPD, I think 8.5 is what our analyst Matt Matthews is predicting.
Right. Yeah.
By the end of the year, down 8.5. I mean, obviously, the numbers, that also takes into account console price drops happened this year, so that's going to put down anyway.
Right.
You know, percentage-wise, just because, you know, if it's just aggregate.
Even if you have the same numbers,
right,
people are spending less money
so,
on that system.
I mean, that's, you know, GameStop also called that out in terms of their down, like, same-store sales or whatever were down.
Right.
Because the price drop on the consoles, so it just, it has an effect. But I don't know. It's, a lot is in flux right now, and, you know, Stringer, the CEO of Sony said that, you know, 2011 is when the game division is going to be profitable. And that's, you know, that's that means he's very optimistic for 2010. That's what that implies.
Yeah. You know. So absolutely. So I guess that's enough on the pandemic. Obviously, it's a very sad story and sad for especially for people who have families this close to the holidays.
Right. Right.
I mean, obviously, you know, it's a small comfort, but I'm sure EA is, you would hope, is giving them ample pay through the end of the year at the very
EA
least.
EA severance is good.
Yeah.
That's what I've been told.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, yeah, it is sad because, let's face it, people are just sweating blood over Saboteur, right? And then they get rewarded with a kick to the curb at the end. And I know that it's business and I know that people are realistic, but I, you know, I got laid off in December once in this very building. Mm-hmm. And that was not fun, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's not fun to get laid off now particularly.
And think about, like, if the game does end up doing well or is well received, you know, the bittersweet feelings you'll have about that.
Yeah, I mean, EA will get all the benefit and those that made it. I mean, who knows? There may be some contract things where people still get royalties based on the performance of the game, but no. Chris, or someone shaking his head no.
I shook my head no, but I just trust me.
Yeah, so.
No comment, but yeah, on that, just.
Yeah, definitely no snappy transition there to this next story out of Eurogamer's Digital Foundry.
Snappy.
Yeah, where they have a story where they basically break down some rumors and speculations from other people and some rumors and speculations that they have been posting about the next iteration of the DS and PSP2.
Well, actually, you know, there is sort of a transition here because we're talking about how difficult...
2011.
Well, not only that, but we're talking about how difficult the transition has been from the last generation to the HD generation, and the handhelds have been the source of kind of consistent profit because they have such low overhead. I mean, you look at like a game like Megaton Strange Journey, like it could have been a console game and it has like the content and structure of a console RPG, but they decided to put it on a handheld because the production costs are so low that they knew they could be more profitable that way.
Right.
And, you know, in Japan especially where developers have been having a hard time making the transition, the handhelds have been the profitable gaming
They've
space.
Saved the industry in a way. And actually, this is something that came out today. I saw this on Gaff. I think we were in the process of doing a post on it when I left the office. Mm-hmm. But Marvelous said in their financial report four out of their five Wii games lost money, and then three out of their four PSP games made money or something like that. So like PSP is actually more profitable for Marvelous than Wii. You know, Marvelous sort of bet the farm on Wii, all their like things with Little King's Story, No More Heroes. You know, I don't know if this report says, but everyone can assume that No More Heroes is the Wii game that made money if they made money off the US version, right?
Right.
And I mean they're hoping to make even more money with the 360 and PS3.
But it's like
version.
It's been a really tough transition because it's not just been about tech or design, you know, next gen design games that, like, you know, like things like, you know, Assassin's Creed that sort of do things that you couldn't do before.
Right.
But it's also been about finding the audience because a lot of people have beat their head against the wall of the Wii with the kind of, you know, budget they would have spent on a PS2 game. So it's not just about money or tech. It's also about finding the audience and failing to find the audience.
Yeah. And basically the crux for this story on Eurogamer is actually looking at the DS2 versus PSP2 is almost a very similar situation that you have this generation with the Wii versus PS3, where it's expected that the DS2 will aim, you know, obviously be a very dramatic increase over the DS, but not going after the absolute bleeding cutting edge on everything, whereas Sony's expected with the PSP2 to go for, like, you know, the Ferrari thing where they want to have the fastest processor, the most graphics, and everything.
So what is that based on? Sorry, I haven't had a chance to read this. Is that based on, like, things that have been leaked or just supposition?
It's things that have been leaked, and it's actually things that they themselves have been told.
I would based on what I think it would be really foolish for Sony to push it. If they've learned anything about the generation transition, you know, and if they've learned anything about the sales of the PSP Go, if they've learned anything about anything, I think making a more expensive, faster, shinier handheld is not the way to go. What they need to do is to Wii it out. You know, like Nintendo's been saying, we're not going to generational transition. We're going
right.
to keep the Wii out there. We think people are satisfied with that. And I think in your hand, the PSP is a very satisfying,
right.
you know, graphical experience. And
but PSP Go has been a disaster.
Well, yeah, I think the PSP
Go
is
for many, many, many reasons.
It'll be price drops. It will make that a more viable position.
But I think something else that has to happen to make it more viable is day and date releases on digital distribution. Yep. In yep. retail, I mean, yep. you have Little Big Planet.
PSP Go is like a beta in the market right now.
Well, I mean, I said this consistently and took some flack for it. The PSP Go was kind of a hack job, and that it was thrown together fairly quickly by the standards of creating a new iteration of a system and shoved out the door as almost a public beta test for both digital distribution.
I don't think it was intended to be a new system per se.
No, it's supposed
to be,
but it's
a variant on an existing system that would change Sony's business model.
Right. That completely changes the business model.
Well, Sony has shown this. They have good engineers, and they have apparently bad businessmen and bad software people. And I'm not trying to be an asshole about it, but it seems like that.
Well, they're a hardware company.
Right. Sony has a long, long legacy of having to do things their own way, and they always put out their own technology. I mean, this goes back to like Beta
mini discs.
Mini discs, yes. Mm-hmm. And Blu-ray. I mean, Blu-ray is like the first standard that's even had any traction whatsoever.
No, that's not true.
No?
3.5-inch floppy disks were made by Sony.
Oh, that's right.
Nice.
Okay. So you have like these two hits, and even Blu-ray is not like a home run because the whole home media video market is kind of imploding.
DVD dominated.
Right. But I mean, this is just kind of how Sony does things. They're like, we're going to do it our way, and we're going to be profitable, or at least we're going to go down swinging.
Well, Sony's done very well. I mean, you know, another standard. You know, I don't think it was a standard, but Trinitron was like the bread and butter of what made Sony huge.
Mm-hmm. Right. And but getting back to kind of the whole, you know, DS2 versus PSP2 in this story, I mean, they are assuming a late 2010 rollout, and probably I'm assuming Japan for the DS2. Do you think that any way it's coming that soon?
No.
Late 2010?
Yeah.
I mean, they're just releasing iteration of the DS hardware.
But the reason they have had multiple iterations of the DS hardware in 1 year is just getting that stuff out the door?
No, I think, this is probably a conversation in itself, but the DSi XL, mm-hmm. I mean, with that, you have Nintendo continuing to mimic the Apple approach to business. And what they've discovered with the DS is that, like an iPod, people will buy a different kind of DS to fit their specific needs. So you have, like, an iPod Shuffle, you have an iPod Nano, you have an iPhone, you have the classic iPod. Each one has a different price. Each one has different functions. You're getting the same thing with the DS. You have the DS Lite, you have the DSi, and now you have the DSi XL,
right.
which is, you know, each one has... They're the same thing, basically, but each one has different functions
and
different
specific
approaches.
Well, couldn't
you say
that about the PSP Go for PSP then, is that they were trying to make it a
PSP
for a different...
I would in fact argue that. I'm not saying they're doing it effectively, but that's exactly what they're trying to do.
I mean, look at the commercials that they have on TV. They're going for this kind of...
Well, the problem with the PSP Go versus the DSi, DSi XL or whatever, is that the DSi, like the changes are really kind of fundamentally changed around what the consumer needs, especially like the XL, which is designed for people who have, you know, worse vision, whereas the PSP Go is really designed around what Sony wants, which is to make money off of direct digital distribution.
Right. Well, what if what they're calling DS2 in here isn't actually a DS2? It's what you're talking about, kind of a fundamental change. But you have the DSi, where it has double the processor speed of the first DS, the CPU processor, and now you have a larger screen, which currently is not higher res. What if they have that same form factor of the bigger screen with higher res and just add like a Tegra, NVIDIA Tegra graphics?
Well, the thing is, right, we're talking about the end of the hard stop genre or generational transition. This could be a rolling evolution of the platform.
It could be, but that introduces a lot of dangers. I mean, look at the DSi. You said that it has twice the processor speed. It has unique functions, but the very first ever DSi exclusive game comes out this week in Japan, a year after the DSi launch. It's taken that long for someone to actually sit down and create a game that is specifically for the DSi, aside from, you know, DSiWare.
Right.
But I mean, there's kind of like this lethargy with that. And
I don't know if
that has to do with like saturation of the market. You know, if you make a DSi only software, like then the millions of people who have DS Lite.
Yeah, but you know, Nintendo managed that just fine with Game Boy Color. Game Boy Color launched with quite a bit of Game Boy Color software, and as soon as the Game Boy Color came out, there were either games that were designed to take advantage of the DS or the Game Boy Color to some degree, but still be backward compatible with the old Game Boy, or they were just exclusively Game Boy Color. Like that happened immediately, and the Game Boy Color was only around for like two, three years before the Game Boy Advance arrived.
I just think in this time, particularly, people are scared to take the risk, the financial risk. So if you'd make more money doing something for just the regular DS, why would you then develop for DSi specifically?
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then why would they even create a DSi to begin with?
I think that it's going to depend. I mean, the thing we're leaving out of this equation because we don't know it is the copious amounts of research that Nintendo has been mm-hmm. doing about its audience mm-hmm. and presumably publishers should be doing about their target market, right? So if you have a game and you're confident that like the people who want to buy the game that you're designing have DSIs, then there's no reason you shouldn't do it. And I don't think that I wouldn't use the word lethargy. It's cautiousness, I think, and I think it's warranted. But that doesn't mean that this possibility of having a rolling, and I made this up just now, but the sort of the rolling generational transition could happen.
It's something that's being presupposed or postulated for quite a while. I mean, there's been stories out there that Nintendo had an entirely different handheld system done, ready to go, and they just killed it because the DS was doing so well, and they basically went back to the drawing board on it. And obviously there hasn't been any strong denial on Nintendo's part, and it makes a lot of sense for a lot of ways. So I guess ultimately, do you guys feel like you need a new DS or PSP?
I feel like I would like for people to start making games that take advantage of the DSi's improved strength.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel right now the DSi, the DS, the classic DS, I mean, that's kind of been pushed as far as it can go, but you double the processing power, you double the RAM. I'm sure you can make some really great-looking games on DSi, but we haven't seen any yet, and the system's been around for a year.
Right.
So I don't feel that there's a need for a DS2 right now. I feel like they just need to actually start making use of what they have.
But do you think one of the reasons people aren't making use of it is because it is so closely associated? If they just broke it and said, here's a new DS, completely new,
people would be more likely to make. Nintendo just hasn't been pushing publishers and developers mm-hmm. including themselves, to do something that's specifically tailored toward the DSi. They have this platform out there. It's sold millions of units. There's a market for it. And you start creating compelling games specifically for DSi, and people will start looking and buying a DSi and getting rid of their DS Lites or giving that to their grandma or whatever.
Do you think that that the mainstream user is purchasing the DSi because of the new functionality, or are they purchasing the DSi because it's just they're thinking they want a DS and that's just the newest model? Like, when you go into a GameStop, that just happens to be like what's
NPDs
newly
are
promoted,
50-50
you know?
Split. NPDs are 50-50
split. I'm sure that a lot of people are just buying what they happen to buy. More aware hardcore gamers are probably picked up the DSi because, hey, it's going to have better games on it because it's more powerful.
Or it's got a camera and I want to draw mustaches.
Yeah. Or I can download games directly from the internet. Maybe there'll be, something awesome in that regard. And, not a lot of that has materialized yet. And I think it really would behoove Nintendo to just really start focusing on the DSi as a platform to differentiate that from the DS, from the mm-hmm. DS Lite, and say, here's something you have in your hands already. Millions of you already own one of these. Here are some really great games that you can't play on the original DS, and build up the DSi as a new platform in itself.
Yeah. Well, Nintendo hasn't always been able to take advantage of the strengths of new platforms. If you look at Zelda Twilight Princess, basically it was a GameCube game that was ported fairly quickly over to the Wii and didn't probably take full advantage of all that functionality. But, of course, we had the new Zelda Wii, which, of course, was announced awkwardly at E3 once again.
Or are we switching to a new topic now?
We are switching to a new topic.
We didn't even talk about what we wanted to see in a PSP 2 or DS2.
Well, it didn't sound like people thought that the new PSP was going to happen.
I think a new PSP is more likely to happen than a new DS,
okay.
But who knows?
I think it's a bad idea, but mm-hmm. that's all I got to say about it.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean it won't happen, though.
So we have this story out of the official Nintendo Magazine UK, a web story. The headline is Zelda Wii expects surprises at E3 2010. And the producer of Zelda, I'm going to fuck his name up.
Eiji Awanuma.
There you go. Told ONM, which is official Nintendo magazine, to expect surprises at next year's E3. When asked how different the new Zelda title will be when it arrives on Wii next year, he replied.
On Wii? Next year?
On Wii. What did I say?
No, ennui is just it's the perpetual state of being a publisher for Wii.
He said it is something we used to talk about with Mr. Miyamoto, and he and I agreed that if we are following the same structure and again, we might not be able to give longtime Zelda fans a fresh surprise. So we have been trying something new in terms of the structure of the Wii version of the new Zelda game this time. I'm really hopeful that people will be surprised with the changes we have implemented for this Wii version. And of course, it's also been confirmed that there's full Wii Motion support, Wii Motion Plus support, and there's going to be the full in-depth interview will be in the official Nintendo magazine UK out December 18th.
Gee, I hope that the new structure they have for the Zelda game is that the first
mini-games.
3 hours of it fucking don't stink like the last two console ones.
I mean, what do you think he's talking about there? Do you think he's talking about the classic Earth, Fire, Wind, Dungeon structure that's kind of become...
Well, it's not even just the association with elements. It's that Zelda has basically become, you spend some time in town, mm-hmm. you go into the overworld, here's an introductory
dungeon. You get a horse.
Then there are 8 more dungeons. In each dungeon, you find a big key, you find a weapon, and you have to use the weapon to hit the boss 3 times to weaken it so that you can attack
it
with your
sword. You will get a boomerang at some point.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I like Zelda, and I thought Twilight Princess was a really fantastic realization of the 3D Zelda concept that started with Ocarina of Time.
Right.
It's getting kind of stale.
So what do you guys want? Whether it's just the Wii Motion Plus, how do you want that utilized? In your perfect world, in your perfect Zelda game, what would you guys want?
Well, Wii Motion Plus isn't going to make a difference for the overall structure of the game.
But it could make a difference in how you control it.
Combat differences?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, specifically combat stuff.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what they're talking about. They're talking about the same structure. So what that says to me is they're talking about the way the whole game is organized.
Maybe you actually play Zelda this time.
Well, you do that
maybe,
in Spirit Tracks.
Or maybe I've seen it postulated by, I'm sure, some ardent fanfic writer that maybe Zelda takes place in a different technological era. I mean, there are trains.
The word is structure.
That doesn't have anything to do with the structure. Okay,
are you telling me that would affect the structure?
No.
Or do you think it's cosmetic?
Darksiders has the same structure as Zelda,
dungeons?
Which it does.
Or do you think it's more of a Majora's Mask
there was,
change in
there
structure?
Was plenty of high-tech in Twilight Princess when you got to the Twilight Realm. That was very, like, science fiction.
Right.
It was still a Zelda game with the traditional
would
structure.
Would it still be a Zelda game if they got rid of dungeons altogether?
It could be.
And it became, like, an open world some kind of game
like
that.
I mean, open world, but you know what I would like?
I don't know if I would want that. Like, I'm hoping that if they're going to change the structure, that they would end up giving me something that I didn't even know I wanted.
I mean, Majora's Mask, I mean, is that the kind of change they're looking at for a structure, something that radically changes the kind of experience in the world that you're playing in?
I don't know if they'll do that, because what they would like is for Zelda to be a multi-million selling series. And Majora's Mask is a cult favorite that some people really love, and the majority of gamers are kind of indifferent to.
Right, but it was also a game that was released very late in the cycle for the 64.
Yeah, but it's a hard structure. That game had a difficult structure.
But I guess what I mean is I'm not specifically saying it has to be, you know...
The same as Majora's
Mask. Yeah, but in something in that vein.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, though, you know, Nintendo, like, will make these statements. I can't think of a specific example, but I know we've seen in the past where Nintendo will make some statement about how the new game in the series is going to be different, and then it's not that different, you know?
So, right.
Yeah, so. I mean, they make small changes, and then they treat it as though it's, you know, we've just changed the world.
Let's not forget the embargo for Spirit Tracks, which we won't even get into.
Yeah, we can't really talk about that. But but I can think of other examples of Nintendo kind of... I don't know. I don't want to, like, talk down to Nintendo about Nintendo, because they make some really great games. I mean,
right.
I've loved the hell out of New Super Mario Bros.
I was going to say, see that.
And that hasn't really changed all that much in a lot of ways from, you know, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there is some insularity to the company and, you know, to the development process. And in a way, that's good, because they kind of come up with their own ideas and do stuff like Wii Sports that no one else in the industry would have done.
Right.
But on the other hand, their games do have a tendency, like their franchises, like they find a place that works and then they kind of stay there and they stagnate. And... You know, I think that they don't really look, a lot of their developers don't look to other games by other developers and to see what's going on, aside from, you know, like Miyamoto browsing the show floor at at E3. And, you know, I can't speak for the man myself, but that's definitely the impression I've gotten just, you know, with interviews with people from Nintendo.
I mean, but clearly with Metroid, they've been willing to take some risks from a franchise standpoint, moving it to first person and now partnering with Team Ninja.
Well, Metroid, the thing is they had nothing to lose with Metroid because, A, no one in Japan gives a shit about the series. B, they didn't have an established development team in Japan.
Skipped a generation.
They didn't have a giant team that was like, you know, established to make a sequel. So then they could take that risk of going with Retro or going with Team Ninja. With Zelda, they have people who are constantly working on prototypes for Zelda games, you know, and Mario games. I mean, look, we got surprised Super Mario Galaxy 2. Who was expecting that? New Super Mario Bros. Wii. You know why? Yeah. So they have, like, tons of people working on crazy prototypes for Mario games all the time, and suddenly the stars aligned, and we got three in one generation instead of one. But, you know, it's like – and in the DS1 as well. So it's like – I don't know. Maybe someone's doing some really cool, new, innovative shit with Zelda, and this time, finally, randomly, it came to light instead of dying in the darkness.
Yeah, I mean, right now, we just got our import copy of 3D Dot Game Heroes, which is basically like a gigantic tribute to the original Zelda, like the NES Zelda. And it's kind of a reminder to me of what I really liked about the original Zelda, which was that it was just this open kind of sandbox sort of game. Before people used terms like sandbox or open world, the game started you out. You were like standing there with no weapons, no nothing. You walk into a cave, you get a sword, and then you're left to your own devices to figure out where the hell to go, what to do.
It was also super minimalist in how it told its story.
It was. And, you know, although there were some problems with the methods that the original Zelda used, it was kind of obtuse and you ended up, like, burning every bush in a screen or bombing every tile to find hidden caves and stuff. And, you know, that kind of thing we could live without. But you take away some of those interface flaws, and what you have is a game that doesn't do the hand-holding that modern Nintendo games do, that's just kind of like,
There's no owl,
there's no fairy, there's no narrative whatsoever. Like old people in caves.
What I was grumbling about earlier is that I played the beginning, and this is, you know, partially on me, but I played the beginning of Wind Waker and then dropped it because I was too busy. And then I played the beginning of Twilight Princess and dropped it because it made me want to die.
Both of those games got off to such a slow start.
And it's like, that's what I want to see. I want to see them just, you know, and it sort of goes to what you're saying. It's like, drop me in the world and let me learn. They're so good. You know, one thing that New Super Mario Bros. Wii does is, you know, I think a lot of games should take notice of this, is that rather than explicitly tutorializing you, and even Nintendo's own games, they will show you something and they'll, like, lead you around. Like, you get red coins and they'll show you what to do to get, like, you know, you'll follow the red coins and you'll learn something. You know what I mean?
When Nintendo has been at its best, it's always been really good about giving you these subtle hints about what to do. Like, you look at the original Metroid. When you first start out, you don't have the ability to turn into a ball and roll beneath things. So if you run to the right, like you're supposed to do in most platformers, left to right, you come to a place where you can't go any further because it's too low and you have to roll beneath it. So that makes you say, what the hell's going on? And you ran back to the left because, you know, you could do that and that was the only place to go, and you get a thing that lets you turn into a ball. And so that tells you, one, you can go in two different directions. It's not like a traditional platformer like Mario where you're going only left or right. And two, you're going to have to find things that help you get through this game. But at no point did the original Metroid say, oh, you can't get through this wall. You must go find the Morph Ball to get beneath this low overhang.
Right.
It used the level design and the game structure to teach you how to do that. And it created this sort of self-reliance that I think I don't think they trust gamers nowadays.
I think people are really. I don't necessarily want to accuse Nintendo of this specifically, but
it's not just Nintendo.
Patronize children, and I think children actually. And I remember this from my childhood, but it's something that's totally not game related. Called this to my mind recently. I won't get into it because it's pretty political. But kids are paying attention.
Yeah,
like, kids know that the world is a difficult place for them, and they are constantly paying attention to figure out what the fuck is going on. We, I think as adults, think we've got it figured out, and we take it more for granted. I think kids, and that's, you know, a lot of Nintendo's audience, and or people who aren't as familiar with gaming, are the kind of people who are like, I don't understand this. I want to figure it out. I want to know what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that there's, you know, it would be an improvement to their games if they played to that strength. And I'm not saying, like you're saying, like the Metroid was a very clear delineated example of how they did that without having it being confusing or obtuse.
Mm-hmm. Well, this segment is running so we don't want to be accused of being obtuse or anything. This segment's running a little long, but Christian, you had a few stories that I know you wanted to hit on real quick, so I want to give you a chance to...
I just want to bring this up real quick.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. Two things came out today from Sony. One is that that the PlayStation 3 will be firmware upgradable to 3D stereoscopic visuals. And it's like, what do people think about this? You know,
I think Sony, as we said earlier in the podcast, is a hardware company, and they have a lot of money invested in making 3D TVs a success. Mm-hmm. And anything they can possibly do to sell a few of those sets is important. I mean, I don't think it's cool. It's a cool concept. We've seen it at shows. It looked interesting. Obviously, we haven't played it for more than 30 minutes, so we don't know if it's migraine inducing. But
the next virtual boy.
This is clearly just a fraction of a percentage of the total audience. So right. I don't think it'd have much of any effect on. But it's definitely cool they have this ability to do this.
They're not the only company that's working on technology like this. I mean, yeah. NVIDIA has APIs for yeah. their graphics cards.
I'm actually really curious how they're actually doing it, because my understanding with Sony's technology, it's tied into HDMI 1.4, which is not in the PlayStation 3. It's 1.3. So who knows how they're going to pull that off?
I kind of dread when games actually, at some horrible point in the future, actually rely on this technology, because yeah. I can't use it. I have a nearsighted eye and a farsighted eye.
Yeah.
So I can't do the stereo vision thing. It makes my brain hurt. My brain won't let me do it.
Well,
so
Rad Racer,
that's going to be a problem for me.
Rad Racer used to make my brain hurt when I was a young child. That turned me off to 3D gaming very, very early.
You're right. It does seem like it's going to be a fraction of people. Who
yeah. I think clearly this is just trying to sell 5 or 6 TVs. And I think that's the core of it, because this will definitely be a big talking point at CES.
So. Yeah, CES. That's true. That's around the corner. The other thing is that there's some discussion, and it's completely inspecific, and it's not been, as far as I know, they haven't said a thing about it, but there's potential of premium PSN subscriptions.
Right. I mean, the original story came out of the San Francisco Examiner. It was a blog post with some of the slides listing. But yeah, it doesn't specifically say whether it's other subscriptions to services like their monthly, I don't know what to even call it, Digital Magazine Core and stuff, whether it's stuff like that, whether they'll have a pay one price for all the video content you want in a month.
Or if it's like, you know, Xbox has silver and gold,
right.
And PlayStation has free, what is amounts to free gold, mm-hmm. but they could turn it into like gold and platinum.
They yeah. could, but that's such an advantage they have over Microsoft.
Well,
right
as long
now.
As they like, keep it free to play, then what's the difference?
What yeah, but I mean, like you look at Microsoft, if you want to do the Netflix things on your PS3 versus your 360,
yeah.
you have to have a gold subscription to do that on Xbox
yeah, but
360. But
like,
on PS3, you just need a disc that they'll send you for free.
But
what
eventually,
you
will need that.
If you say, you know, games. You can play online for free as much as you want, but if you're a platinum member, you can have clans or something that only the hardcore.
Yeah, incentives like that would be cool, but I would not want for them to take away current privileges.
If they do that, they're idiots.
Exist, that are, you know, they exist now for free.
Yeah,
that would be terrible.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If they're going to do it, they have to add new features that they then charge.
Yeah,
for.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's all speculative.
I mean, who knows? Sony thinks they're going to be making more money in 2011 for some reason, other than their system sales, which would have been really strong as of late.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, they have something up their sleeves. I mean, the wand is also. I wish that had a name. I'm so tired of calling it the wand or whatever. Motion control.
Yeah, I mean, this still isn't a good name for the Wii remote.
Yeah, but that's what it's called.
Yeah.
People call it the Wiimote, but I hate that.
Yeah. We're forbidden from using that term. Have been for some time. So what else you got? Is that everything? Or
well,
you
here,
had one more,
have,
right?
This is sort of, you know, you talked about how since I'm not a developer, I don't have my own segment, but let's call this the Gama Sutra segment, because this is sort of off the sort of beaten path of, I think, of the kind of news that 1UP readers might be more familiar with. So there's a guy called Chris Hecker. He is a really respected programmer and designer. He's worked on independent games, and he actually was at Maxis, and he worked on Spore mm-hmm. pretty instrumentally in implementing some of the...
I think he's probably one of the better-known programmers in the industry.
Yeah, and he is he worked really hard on some of the really innovative like creature stuff and technology that helped enable some of that like organic sort of growth stuff in Spore. And he recently gave a speech, and this was late last week, and it was asking, okay, you know, we spend a lot of time, especially, and you have to remember this is, again, aimed at, this is a forum for developers, we spend a lot of time at these conferences talking about how to make games, and he himself has spent a lot of time delivering, you know, speeches about that, but we have to spend more time asking why we're making the games we're making, what's the creative drive, because if we don't, we're going to pin ourselves into a creative corner in this medium, which has the possibility of becoming the dominant cultural form of the 21st century, will end up being the next comic books.
Well, the timing on this story was actually it was kind of funny for me because, you know, last week I reviewed New Super Mario Bros. Wii and gave it an A+ out of A+, and that was, you know, 10 out of 10, A+ out of A+, whatever.
What does Metacritic call an A+?
They're calling it 100, who gives
a
f-
they call it 100, which ironically is exactly what an A is on Metacritic, so.
I'm just fucking with you.
Interesting. Thanks for
Let's
that.
Not go there. Anyway, but I gave it such a high score primarily on the strength of the fact that it's such an inclusive game, mm-hmm. that Nintendo, I mean, I talked about this last week on the show, but Nintendo went out of their way to create a game that could be played, you know, for the hardcore gamer, the traditional Mario fan, but also for people who don't really play video games. Like, there are a lot of really smart design decisions that make it inclusive for anyone who has an interest in picking up a controller and seeing what this Mario game is about. It can be fun for everyone. And I really appreciated that. But then, you know, of course, that caused some 1UP user to send me an angry tirade by private message telling me that I'm stupid and that the only reason I gave it such a good score was nostalgia, blah, blah, blah. And to which I responded by private message to say, well, no, if you really read the review, you'd understand that there was... I was thinking outside of myself, actually. I was looking at what this game brings to the medium. And, you know, it's important to get games like this because we don't want the medium to become the equivalent of comic books, which right. are, like,
Unless
totally focused
probably,
on,
yeah.
laser-focused on, you know, stunted man-children, basically. What comic books have become, you know, the mainstream comic books, Marvel, DC, is really, it's embarrassing. And video games have... very much the potential to fall into that same rut unless we have games that reach out and try to be an inclusive experience and aren't just about being in a first-person perspective with a gun at your hand blowing things up.
And there's another problem with the comic book model, which is that comic books as a business are designed to pump all of the money out of the people who like comic books, but not to bring anyone who doesn't like comic books into comic books. Like, right now, my boyfriend is reading Blackest Night, which mm-hmm. is this DC thing that's like... Like Green Lantern has the Blackest Night thing at the top of the, you know, cover.
Yeah,
and
it's
so does,
each one
it's like
focuses
this meta
on one
crossover
character.
Story
yeah.
that I when he talks about it, I just say, yeah, that's nice, dear. But it's like, you know,
but unless you follow it, you know the backgrounds and everything going on with these characters.
It's an effective way to pump money out of the audience.
Right.
And I'm not saying it doesn't deliver or really because he loves it, and so does some of my other friends. Like, it's a really great,
but it requires to be part
story.
Of that world and part right. of that industry and being actually involved into it. I think for, you know, from my perspective, with a lot of games these days, I mean, it seems like games are designed, and I'm generalizing here in much the same way, about the games are made to create franchises, to sell DLC mm-hmm. as businesses, mm-hmm. first and foremost.
Well, look at Dragon
than,
Age, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's right there in the game. And I mean, that's a huge, even talking to some, you know, some of the guys from BioWare, they're really proud of that. And they actually think that's, you know, for them, it's a good thing.
I think for
from
Dragon
a business
Age,
standpoint.
No, I think for Dragon Age in general, that's the right approach for that game. Like, no, that is a comic book audience game, right?
Yeah. Although the hooks that they actually put in the game are kind of questionable. Penny Arcade probably hit that right on the head.
Yeah.
But no, I agree. Like, you know, the comic books are designed for the comic book audience, and video games, they have the potential to do that. I mean, especially MMOs.
But I think it's totally fine to have that portion of gaming exist, and there's
sure,
no reason
sure.
it can't be.
There should be games.
Okay,
like
so
that.
Where's the other portion, Alice?
Right, then that's the thing.
I mean, you have the stat that 50% of gamers are female, and most of those gamers are not playing console games. They're not playing on 360 PS3. They're playing games online, whether they're free-to-play MMOs.
No, they're playing on Facebook.
Or they're just playing Facebook, or they're just playing Yahoo Solitaire. I mean, those right. gamers exist, but they're playing with games as toys versus games as narrative
interactive
experiences.
They also don't call themselves gamers.
Right.
They
no,
don't
absolutely.
Think, I am a gamer. Yeah. They think, oh, sometimes video games are fun.
Because those yeah. games, those types of games do exist, and that portion of gaming does exist, but yeah, like you said, they don't identify themselves as gamers, and as a hardcore gamer you wouldn't necessarily even know that other portion of gaming exists, you know.
Right.
It's like that portion of gaming also is so much cheaper to make. It's like the development money going like millions of dollars into making video games, like that all goes into like the hardcore.
Right. But I think ultimately, I mean, it's more of, I think this more of is going to the heart of, there are, you know, many types of games, but there, at its very core, there are two very specific types of games. You have games that are trying to tell a story, games as a narrative, interactive narrative device, and then you have games that are toys. Some games are designed to be toys. I mean, look at a game like Boomblocks. It's not designed to tell you a story. It's not designed. Mm-hmm. It can be designed to offer you an experience, but it's not an artistic narrative.
I don't think that's necessarily how I'd break down games, because if you look at something like Street Fighter or Ikaruga,
right,
like those are very much in the hardcore gaming box, they're not.
How would you break it down?
I would break it down as games for gamers and games for everyone.
But ultimately, what does that mean? Those terms are thrown around all the time. But
that means that they are building on these concepts and tenets.
They're building on, I think what you're saying, or like I was talking about this earlier today, and this is something that's come up a lot. And actually, quite a while ago, Engai wrote something really smart about this that we should probably dig up and make people read again, which is that the hardcore casual dichotomy mm-hmm. is a false, and not only beyond is it false, it's not that useful, because you really need to think about like what the people you want to play your game actually like, and you don't think about, you know, making one or the other. I can't articulate this really effectively as I would like, but it's about creating games, you know, not blindly following, oh yeah, people like, you know, women like to play games about cakes,
right,
you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like,
I do love me some cake.
Yeah, I mean, I very
way
specifically
to play into the stereotype, Alice.
I very specifically said games for gamers and games for people who don't consider
themselves
gamers.
You did say everyone else, but
I don't break it down into the hardcore casual thing, mm-hmm. because that is, I agree, that is kind of a false dichotomy, although right. that is how a lot of people design games now.
It's kind of like a weird sliding scale, I guess, if you would kind of I have friends that don't consider themselves gamers, but they do own like one, maybe two consoles,
right,
you know, or they have like the handheld or something, and they do, you know, play some titles that I would consider hardcore titles. It always surprises me when they ask me about like X title or Y title, and it's not a, you know, a game that I would necessarily think that the more quote unquote casual audience would even know about or care about. So I mean, I think we might have to just identify what types of game appeal to which types of people, and not mm-hmm. really think of it as like a two-party system.
I mean, I think so much of it. I mean, I think one of the things that I think is healthy about our industry is the burgeoning indie game scene. Whereas, I mean, something that really pushed the medium for films in the early 90s, you had a lot of indie filmmakers that struck it big and were really forcing Hollywood to kind of accept different ways of making films, different ways to tell stories. And I think you have a lot of that with the indie game
yeah,
scene
but,
pushing
I mean,
into.
He specifically addresses that, actually.
Right.
And mm-hmm. To go into that, let me find it here. This is like a.
Because right now, like.
Oh, actually, that was more in the follow-up.
90% of games are designed to be Hollywood blockbusters. They want to sell.
Yeah.
They wanted to have 80% of their sales in the first 3 weeks.
Well, I don't think that's. I think your numbers there are way off, because there are a lot of games that are not, you know,
okay,
a big budget.
Sorry,
blockbuster.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should like main.
Maybe
like mainstream
you mean the games that we cover.
Mainstream, yeah, the ones that reach the largest audience. Yeah, I mean mainstream AAA console and PC gamers. I guess yeah.
maybe not even reach the largest audience.
Yeah, that's
the wrong word. Sell
the
most.
But I think you know what I meant by that is the games that generate the most money. Yeah, I mean that's how they're designed. I mean, obviously, some of the exceptions being MMOs and World of Warcraft.
Well, I mean, let's look at
Warcraft.
So this takes us back to the pandemic question, right? Mm-hmm. If you can't, you know, make a profitable game, then you're fucked, right?
Yeah.
And this generation is, you know, I've talked to more than one developer and publisher now about this now, but it's like the A-tier games are making, like console games, are making money, and a lot of them are making money hand over fist, but the B-tier
right.
of sales and quality, you know, they're not initially that much cheaper to make, and they're losing money hand over fist. And then some of the major publishers are being able to balance this, right? But that's a problem with the form or with you know business. But,
yeah.
But it's.
I mean, I guess one of the differences with you know the film to game comparison is, you know, films only vary. There's only about four or five. There've only been four or five "quote unquote" generational shifts of film. Mm-hmm. You had silent to talkies, talkies black and white to color. You had, you know.
Well, there was a studio era.
Yeah.
Then there was the auteur era. Then kind of the modern. I don't know what the hell we're in now.
Once everything. Yeah. I mean that basically. Yeah. And then you went widescreen, and then you had digital special effects, and now you have the transitional between film and digital, and that's really it compared to games, which has been much more focused within. You have about 30 to 40 years where you have a fundamental difference in how games are made and every 5 to 6 years. I mean, that's a fundamentally different world than film.
This is also a really important point that I think talks to kind of a similar from that perspective. And I'm going to quote the article. It's film, you know, he's saying it's a respectable medium, right? They can shovel out as much crap as they want. It doesn't affect their ability to be considered an art. The New York Times isn't going to demote them out of the art section because of Saw 4. Right? But the thing is, if we haven't established that we can make, you know, Taxi Driver.
Our video game is going to be phased out of the New York Times art section because of Saw
the video
game.
No, they're never
going to
fucking get in.
But I'm going to kind of quote.
Because they are all Saw the video game.
But
Seth Scheisel does, I mean, does some work. But if it's a Beatles, like, look, if Beatles Rock Band is what it takes to get into the art section, and don't get me wrong, because I'm not going to say Beatles Rock Band's a bad game, and we all know it's a very good game, and Harmonix put a lot of work into it, et cetera, ad infinitum. But it's still piggybacking on the fucking
Beatles. It's riding the Beatles' fabulous red coattails.
But ultimately, I mean, there are two problems here. You have the problems in that games aren't necessarily moving as fast as some people would like into more of a serious kind of artistic medium. But you also have a situation where you have the majority of people who are in charge of deeming things art are too fucking old and don't understand gaming, and until they just all die off, it's never going to be considered.
I don't think we can tell ourselves that and just be comfortable with that.
That's why I mentioned both things.
I mean?
That is a statement of fact in a lot of ways.
I love Gears of War, and I've said this before, but do you think that, you know,
absolutely
in 20
not.
Years when all the art critics are dead, that like Gears of War 12 is going to be considered art? No,
right.
It's not.
Absolutely
finally,
not.
The New York Times appreciates the finer art of curb stopping.
absolutely not. I totally agree with you, but I think, you know, there's no perfect example. You're right. But I think there is an art to what Nintendo's been able to do with Mario and offering a consistent experience over 20 to 30 years that still reaches people of every generation. There's something artistic about that.
That's interesting.
Something fundamental.
This is really interesting because this is something else that he says. You know, what's the easiest film to make? I claim the easiest film to make is to put a camera in a room with some people and they talk. Mm-hmm. You get a camera and you can do that for $500. What's the hardest film to make? It's got explosions and spaceships and lasers flying. And then in contrast, what's the easiest game to make? It's got explosions, maybe elves or orcs, and whatever. What's the hardest game to make? Well, it's got some people in a room talking.
That's a really good point.
I think but to your point, I think the equivalent of some people in a room talking might be New Super Mario Bros. Wii.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something elegant and simple, right? There might not be a movie of people in a room talking, literally, right? And we'll see if, Heavy Rain.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, I haven't played a lot of Heavy Rain, but I get the impression that its aspiration is to be like CSI. You know, essentially,
I think that's a misnomer. It's more of a. I mean, there's a lot of
CSI is idiotic.
There's a lot of different stories, and all the stories have different storytelling devices. There's one part of the game that is CSI, but on top of that, you have the fact that the person is a recovering junkie who has to deal with, you know,
it's going to be a lot
in
the
drug abuse.
We're going to have to see what the quality of the storytelling is there. And I mean, something that Chris talked about, which there's a follow up story because he gave the speech at the IGDA Leadership Forum,
right?
And then he gave it again at MIGS, the Montreal International Games Summit, with some modifications. And then during the Q&A session, we got some more stuff out of him. And, you know, a lot of people brought up, hey, indie developers are pushing, are pushing the medium. And that's definitely true. And actually, Chris, you know, he quit Maxis and he is an indie developer again now. So he definitely doesn't think that it's invalid. And I met him at GDC China, and he's very passionate about indies, actually. And he thinks that they have tremendous potential. But can't be the only ones pushing it. You know, when we're talking about the independent film movement of the 90s that really, you know, pushed quality. And that was in response to the fact that Hollywood got caught up in blockbusters.
Yeah,
and
the Schwarzenegger, Stallone era.
You know, exactly. Like, it was a response to, to the Commando, et cetera.
But even that was a response to the kind of introverted, introspective anti-heroes of the, mid to late 70s.
Yeah, we talk about Taxi Driver, begets Commando, Commando begets Boys Don't Cry.
It's cyclical. No, but you're right. I mean everything in society is cyclical to a certain extent.
But I feel like I think there's a quote in here. It's like, you know, you'll read an interview with an author, right? Mm-hmm. And the author will say, "I had to write this book because my girlfriend broke up with me."
Yeah.
Unless you're putting your girlfriend in as like a horde queen or some shit in like a game, like, I mean, what is your, you know, how the medium isn't
right.
It's, I guess the fundamental question to get all the way back is fundamental question of the why question is like, do we have a meaningful, personally meaningful artistic impetus to make games, or do we just think games are cool? And we should not, again, you know, this man, he worked on Spore. He's not against large scale commercial products. And he says that, you know, before we haven't touched on those quotes, but you know, it's like, and like I said, I love Gears of War, right? And I love Final Fantasy. I am the first in line to buy expensive, high-scale commercial product games. But there's so much more that could be happening right now, and it's. But and then we see with pandemic, it's a tough market. I'm not, you know.
I guess for some people, and we obviously we've heard this from you know a lot of different people, and I guess for some people, until it's all one medium, one console,
that's never
going to
happen.
Kind of stuff.
It's splintering more than yeah. than it's not coming together. It's splintering.
Well, but I think a lot of things are splintering. I mean, all forms of media are becoming more niche and more splintered.
Yes.
I mean,
you
look at news.
People are becoming so much movies. More elective about yeah. what they participate in, and that's actually – I mean
– So maybe in some ways other mediums are actually in a bizarre, almost perverse way following games.
If you look at politics right now, that's definitely a big reason the politics in America are so vitriolic is because
so many are going rogue.
No, but
people are living in bubbles.
Yeah, people only want to hear what they agree with. You're absolutely right. And I think, not to get on the little soapbox, but I think that's a problem, and it's a problem in politics, and I think it can be a problem.
No, I mean, I think that's
in the gaming space.
I'm not getting a soapbox because I think that the problem exists in the right, left, and the fact that
yeah.
we, you know, even break it down the right and left when there should be more than two choices, you know, or like it's people, they get. With the era of the internet and the fact that we can be completely elective about whom we speak to and what we speak about, you know, makes it so much easier to just cocoon. And
yeah.
that
right. Ironically, as the world gets larger, your social circle gets smaller. Is that what you're saying?
I think your social circle gets more homogenous, maybe.
Well, on that note, I think we've covered about everything we're going to cover in the new segment. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to come down to maybe a little more lowbrow conversations, maybe. We're going to talk about some elves, some knights, some Jedi knights perhaps, and other talks. So we'll be right back. All right, well, we've taken a few minutes to collect our thoughts after that marathon news and feature discussion.
And philosophy.
Yeah, but I enjoyed that. Hopefully everyone who's listening at home enjoyed it as well. And if not, that's why we have this segment, What You've Been Playing.
Yeah.
We're going to start with Alice, since she was nice enough to join us, but she has underneath a crunch of having to leave at some point in the very near future. So I wanted to go ahead and have her talk about what she's been playing.
No, I'm just kidding. I just recently finished up Lego Indiana Jones 2.
There was a first one?
There was a first one that had the...
you see, Kristen's rolling his eyes. And in fact, I did something similar earlier today when I was talking to you about it. Where you hear Lego and Indiana Jones 2, and you're like, oh, awesome, they're making another game, just like every other Lego game ever made, and you
there are actually
disagreed with me.
A few differences in this one that I
So tell
I'm
me
surprised.
Why I should really care about Lego and Indiana Jones 2.
Yeah, I'm not interested in the game at all, but I loved your deck for the review.
Oh, what was my deck? It was something like
isn't just knowledge.
Right.
That was awesome.
Well, because, I actually thought Lego Indiana Jones 1 was an okay game, but, you know, it had a few flaws. You know, mm-hmm. I love Indiana Jones, but, you know, when you broke it down into different characters that you can unlock and their powers and whatnot,
Sala's not as cool as Darth Vader.
Right, it's
yeah.
just like it's not
what
as fun
saying?
As lightsabers
Darth Vader
and
does not sing.
Pistols and whatnot. You know?
Very dangerous.
There's only so many types of Nazis or whatever you can unlock,
right.
And until you're like, why am I doing this? But
that's a deep question in and of itself. Why am I unlocking Nazis?
And then Lego Indiana Jones 2, I'm kind of like, that's lame. The first game was the first three classic movies, and
right.
then this is Kingdom Skull. What the heck?
So
or
the entire
Kingdom
game is just
Skull.
One movie this time around.
No,
no,
it's actually.
Does it have like a bunch of the Marvel comics?
No,
is it the Choose Your Own Adventure books? Because I loved those as a kid.
Shh. No. It revisits the first three movies, and then there's also the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. But they changed some things to actually make it, it feels like one of the largest Lego licensed games mm-hmm. to date.
A lot of content there.
Yes.
So
each of the movies has its own hub world. Before, there's one hub world that you go into each of the chapters and you play through it like that and you unlock stuff in the hub world. Now it's each movie has its own themed hub world and all the things to unlock within that hub world.
Right.
And, you know, so they're...
You say you revisit the old movies. Do they have some of the same sequences in the game again, or is it all new sequences? Like, what part of the movies? Like, for example, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
They focus on different parts of that the first game didn't.
Yeah, because the first game of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, I remember the chase sequence by the... And I remember the part by the, like, the stealth bomber in the middle of the desert. And that's kind of it. I remember at the beginning with the rock falling towards me, and that's about it.
Yeah, some of the parts that were done in cutscenes in the first game, are, you now play, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And you know, or like they'll do something, and the kind of the cutscenes like way like more humorous than in the original game or something. You know, they'll just do something like out of left field, like
right? But you're talking more about changes in the kind of presentation versus the actual game. I mean, you said there were some changes in the way you actually play the game, right. The way you experience, specifically co-op.
Right. Co-op is actually one of the main reasons I really like it and enjoy the LEGO games. But before, you would always have to be on the same screen.
Mm-hmm. And still no online co-op, right?
No.
Okay.
But you jump – I mean, it's fun to play in the same room. So.
Right. I mean, it's part of the appeal.
Yeah. Before you'd be stuck on one screen, if your friend, you know, ran further ahead or jumped up high, you would die. Mm-hmm. You know, if you weren't fast enough to keep up, you know, you could scroll off and kill your partner. But now, actually, they introduced, like, a seamless co-op thing where if you guys run away from each other, the screen will just split seamlessly.
The way you're describing it sounds very similar to Bionic Commando
yep.
Rearmed.
Exactly.
The way it did that.
Right. And I actually didn't play that, so.
Well, get on that right now.
But it's really cool because it's not just, you know, a straight line down the middle, horizontally or vertically. It's dynamic depending on where your partner is. So you always know which way to run to have the seams, you know, reform back into the one screen. So it's really nice because you can be off doing whatever you want and your friend can still be doing off whatever they want without killing each other. But you could also come together, be cooperative. You can, you know. And it also allows for the levels to be, I think, a lot larger. The hub worlds are a lot larger. There are a ton more unlockables, but also there's a level creator.
See, that's the part I think that's so unique because within the world, I mean, I would assume that the puzzles are very similar to what they've been throughout the series.
Yeah, it's like a break a bunch of stuff, get a bunch of money, find a little piece, put it in something else, turn the key, that kind of
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, really I'd say for me personally, I'm kind of over that as a mechanic. It's just, it's gotten kind of old and
it's
stale
so
for me.
It's so satisfying when you like explode blocks. Like, I had something about that sound.
It was really satisfying
me.
Like 4 years ago. And I guess it's some
I
people.
I like slot
it,
machines.
Some people,
I
exactly.
like that sound.
You're going to be that crazy old lady, and when you're 60 years old, just feeding the nickel slots in Vegas.
You could play nickel
I've
slots
I've seen her
forever.
In Vegas. She's already that way.
Hey, I win. Okay, I'm good at slots. You can be good at them. I promise.
Well, I'm sorry for taking you on that tangent, but the level creator is actually something that's interesting to me. Yep. I mean, did you make any levels?
Yeah, and this is
How
actually,
easy is it to
I was
use?
A little bit... I was curious about the level creator because it actually seems like a pretty hardcore addition, you know? And if you think about, you know, the 8-year-olds or 7-year-olds that play this game, will they even want a level creator? And it's...
Speaking as a former 7-year-old, I'd say yes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but I can build stuff, you know, with real Legos in real life, and I can get that you would mechanically put them together and you can create something. But when you have, like, a controller and then you have to go through all these menus and there are all these options...
But I would feel like that tool's not there for one kid playing by himself. It's for a kid playing with other kids or for a parent who's actually playing with the kids and actually kind of collaborating with each other,
Can you share levels online?
I actually don't know.
With your friends list?
I don't think you can.
Yeah, I doubt
that's
it.
That's a waste.
Yeah.
But that's for the LEGO MMO, possibly. But so you can create these levels, and you can actually make them pretty complex. Like, the tools allow you to make levels that are like the ones that are in the game.
Can you bring story into your levels?
They also have separate, adventure editor, but it's not as robust as the actual level editor in that you can control like I want this block with this tree and like this will give this reward.
In the adventure editor, can you be like indie exit or interstage left, slips on banana peel, exit
no,
stage
no, no, no. It's basically like you choose like, oh, I want a level from Temple of Doom and they're looking for this item and like it'll redo the cutscenes with the choices that you make, but it's all very limited options.
Yeah.
And you can choose which characters you want to play out that scene, but they're all, you know, recycled scenes from the actual game. So the level editor is where it's at if you want to have that kind of finite control. Because you can, in the level editor, say Indiana Jones comes in at this spot and then the exit of the level is in that spot and you need to get this thing to unlock that thing.
So do you think they put that in there because they were just out of ideas on how to create their own levels and they're just going to watch and see what other people do?
Well, if you can't like share them, how would they watch?
Maybe they have a way of seeing it.
It's like The Last Starfighter. They're actually secretly watching you.
Oh gosh, it's like built-in beaming.
I actually bought that on Blu-ray recently.
You do a good enough level and suddenly the screen changes and it's like, here's an application for design position at Traveler's Tales.
You wake up the next morning and there's a beta in bed with you.
I could be wrong. It could be that you can share them online. I actually don't know.
Okay. That would seem essential. But anyway, your mission now is to go into the level editor and create for me a Lego version of Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. It's okay to use the Marion character as Sophia Hapgood. I'm not going to complain. It's fine.
How about I use the Legos and make like a big middle finger to you? No, I'm just kidding.
That was just rude,
Alice. I know. Well, no, it actually, if I had the time to plop down to make my own level, I think I would actually... It would be pretty fun because, you know, building stuff with Legos is like an essential part of what made Legos popular to begin with. So it's good to see them throwing back the creative, you know, tools in there.
It's a shame it's within the context of branding. That's the big problem with Legos, I think, today is that it's all fucking licensed.
Well, yeah, because you can't – I mean, to me –
there's no more just like adventure set.
They got rid of space Legos. All there is Star Wars Legos. What if you think Star Wars sucks? Like me.
Right. Then you build the Starship Enterprise out of Star Wars Legos.
What about you build your own Starship? It's neither neither the Enterprise nor the Millennium Falcon.
So you've been playing anything else, or you've been too busy wrangling everything up for us around here?
That, but I'm also working on my next review, which is already late because the game came out. But it's Harvest Moon, which
and you've
I'm
been
sure
on epic quests associated with
Harvest
this game.
Moon. Yes. What? What's the subtitle?
There are two Harvest Moon games that just came out. There was one on Wii, which I'm not playing right now. I'm playing Sunshine Islands, which
for
is the DS one.
Yes.
Is that what you get? Is that what creates Rainbow Islands? You have the Sunshine Islands and they
and then there's
they
rainy
shine
islands
through like
then,
the low angle rainy islands and then you get Rainbow Islands.
No. Oh. They're Sunshine Islands because you have to get these sunshine runes and they.
So you love the Harvest Moon series.
I do. I should probably do a count one day, but I would venture a guess that I own about 80 to 90% of every Harvest Moon game. So
I thought you were going to say 80 to 90 Harvest Moon games.
it's
up to Mega Man levels at this point.
No. I think I own something like 80 to 90%.
So what's the hook for this game? Why does it exist?
It exists for fans that like the game because they apparently make enough money off of the same fans buying every single iteration of their games.
This is exactly what Chris Hecker was complaining about. God.
I know. We just talked about
this.
Alice,
you're part of the problem.
Why do you buy these games for free plushies?
They have free plushies.
No, seriously. What the fuck is the... So, please.
It's a farming sim,
but on an island. So you raise bananas and coconuts?
They don't always have islands.
It's like Sharon 4.
I know they're not. No, I'm asking this one. What... is the story. So it's just basically Harvest Moon with a new coat of paint.
Yes. They always are like that. But, you know, each one has...
Rune Factory's not like that.
Rune Factory, actually, I really love. Rune Factory Frontier from Marvelous on Wii actually is probably, like, the best Harvest Moon game to come out.
Why don't you play Farmville and save money?
Okay, I actually refuse to play Farmville.
That's not how you save money. That's no. Why I think Zynga's making so much money. You don't save any money by playing Farmville. No.
It's like the free crack rock you get on 14th Street at 3 a.m. It's not free.
The reason
kids.
I like Harvest Moon games, I guess it's, you know, it plays into my addictive personality or whatever, and it's also safe because I know, you know, what I'm going to be getting out of the experience.
You know, you're not
going to
be
disappointed. But they add just enough new things in there to where I feel like it was worth it for me to buy it to play it. And also, after a while, after you've got, you know, like 10 versions of this game, you kind of don't want to stop, you know.
Sure. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't have anything wrong with that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. We all do that. We all like series. I think as gamers, we all enjoy the concept of series. And I'm not even saying in an accusatory way. I just want to know what's going on with the new Harvest Moon.
Okay, so you are on these islands.
Were you just channeling Shane there?
That was very shameless.
You get a farm. You must build up your farm. You know, you get money. It's all about being like a model citizen, you know. You have your farm. You raise crops. You get, you know, cool, cute farm animals that you raise. They give you products. You make money. The more money you get, the more you can pump into your village or town or whatever the storyline is. And then you, like, raise this town out of its economic hardships. You know, you grow it. More people come.
So it's a communist utopia you're creating for yourself on an island off
whatever,
the coast.
Whatever, Sarah.
You save the fucking world, okay, in this game.
So the question, you know, in my mind is like, so have they successfully, you know, I mean, you seem to be enjoying it. So do you think that they successfully do it every time? Have they managed to push this one forward, or is it just, you know, more of the same? Is it skippable?
I mean, it's
now you can plant coconut trees.
No, for the Harvest Moon fan that likes the DS, I guess, series of the Harvest Moon Harvest Moon games, this one is the best one that's come out so far for DS. They all kind of have, it's like Final Fantasy in that, like, some of them are in the same world, kind of. So the DS ones are all kind of, like, in the same world. Some of the characters are recurring, and, you know, the same sort of town names are.
Am I confusing my series, or is this the one where you tend to start out in, like, indentured servitude and you have to work your way up, or is that a difference?
It's Animal Crossing.
Oh, those are completely different. I totally forgot.
Yeah, I don't tell you, never get this confused. Yeah.
Yes, well, so I mean, I guess I'm stupid.
You guys all jumped on me at one time. What is the fundamental difference?
No, I'm actually kidding. I think they are pretty similar.
Yeah.
What?
Aren't they kind of both farming sims, or is one more the life sim?
Animal Crossing isn't really about farming. It's more about, like, doing dumb things for your stupid animal pals.
Oh.
Yeah, Harvest Moon is very structured, and it's very, like, economy-based. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of, like, micromanaging your finances.
Animal Crossing is a lot more freeform.
It's a sim. It is like a farming life simulation. You crops take a certain amount of days to grow.
So what are you doing here in San Francisco? Why didn't you move out to the Bible Belt in the Midwest of the United States?
This and started right?
I grew up in Texas. Clearly, you were the one who should have been there.
No,
my first job
like
was with the Department
cute.
Of Agriculture.
Hey, California.
Wait,
really?
We got it all mixed up.
Wait, one of the biggest farming states.
Wait, what did you do?
I picked cotton.
Holy shit.
And then I measured it.
That's awesome.
Wow.
I had no
put
idea.
It on a centrifuge to see how many inches of cotton roots there were.
Nice.
It was exciting.
Learn something new every week.
Wow. Yeah. I just pet cute cows and shit. Get, like, cute eggs.
That may be
from the cow? Wait, you get eggs from the cow?
No, you get eggs from the chicken.
What kind of fucked up farm is this?
And then I give it to my boyfriend, who will one day love me and marry me, and then we'll have kids.
I was going to say, if this was the island of Farmer Dr. Moreau, I'm right there.
Harvest Moon genetic experiments?
Yes. I would do that.
Harvest Moon GMO?
Gattaca.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, right. But I don't know why I love these games. I just...
Be glad you do. Them. I mean, it's everyone has something that they just kind of enjoy for the fuck of it, so...
It's the same reason I play WoW still. 5 years. Holy crap.
Yeah, I reinstalled it. Still haven't played it again. I need to play it some more at some point. So... Christian.
Yes.
You've been playing Dragon Age.
I've been playing Dragon Age,
We've kind of talked about it on a very surface level, but we haven't really gotten very hardcore with it.
I wish I could. Unfortunately, I'm only a couple hours in. I played through my intro. I'm a human noble.
Can you be a human non-noble?
I believe it's
called a human ignoble.
So I wanted to be a warrior characters. I enjoy warrior mm-hmm. characters. And for humans, if you're a warrior, you're human
you
noble.
You have to be noble.
You have to be noble.
Because otherwise you can't afford the armor.
Only choice option to me. I did debate dwarves, fuck elves. But
there's actually a video on my game videos of exactly that happening.
Yeah, yeah, that was. I was like, hey, we've arrived. We've been, you know.
So you're a human noble.
I'm a human noble. So I played through the intro, which I really enjoyed. You know, everyone knows, even the listeners by this point have figured out that I'm the JRPG guy. Mm. I haven't really given a lot of time to BioWare's games in the past, and
Oh, that's right. This is your first Whitey RPG.
This is to my own... Hey, that's how I put it on Twitter. I tend to be a little bit... yeah.
He's
Are
racist.
You, playing with
you can
or
self-apply
without the blood,
that term.
Yeah.
The persistent gore.
The persistent gore is really silly. I haven't turned it off yet, but
you
I'm sure...
You should turn it off.
I will.
Does look silly, especially with the dog.
The dog, yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's like covered in blood.
I definitely seeing the pros and the cons of playing a Western developed RPG from the immediate step. And to clarify, you know, I haven't played BioWare games really before. I started KOTOR, then I remembered I hated Star Wars.
Bastard.
I didn't play Mass Effect, and I don't have a good reason. I just never got around
to it. Because you don't like Star Trek?
I love Star Trek.
Actually. Oh, well, you should play Mass Effect.
Yeah.
It's more than just Star Trek.
It's like Star Trek fan fiction with the serial numbers filed off.
I should it's play good. It. I don't really have anything good. Against Mass Effect, actually. I just never got around to it. You know, there's a lot of games. So it's not like a real antipathy towards it or anything. I just never happened to. But this, it's like, you know, I did a little pros and cons thing on my blog. And one of the big pros for this is, you know, this is a reaction. Anyone heard me whining about Star Ocean earlier this year?
Yeah.
There will never be a cat girl in a Moe fucking disaster.
Okay,
in
none of that, yeah.
In this game.
Did you like Lord of the Rings?
I don't like Lord of the Rings.
That's interesting. But you seem to be enjoying Dragon Age?
Well, here's the thing. This is how I put it, and not to make this all about me, but you are asking.
But you're the one playing.
Right. Like,
this is about you.
Fantasy, I have this weird relationship with the with fantasy genre, which is that I fucking despise it, except for when I adore it. And it's really hard for me to find, some genres, you know, you're more or less interested in, and it's really hard for me to find those things unless just sticking my head down and getting in, right? Like, there's some fantasy novels that I love, but then sort of, you know, a lot of, like, I don't like the Lord of the Rings movies at all. I think they're really boring. I mean,
those are the ones that I enjoy. I remember reading the novelization sequel to Willow. I enjoyed that.
I loved Willow. So yeah, like I said, there's some various. It's very hit or miss with me as a genre. And so far,
do you prefer the Willow arcade game or the NES game?
I never really played the arcade game that much. So I mean, NES game by default. But nice Retronauts blip
always.
But no, I mean. Yeah, like, one thing I hate about JRPGs, or that gets frustrating, is that, you know, you talk to townspeople and they just, like, go, they say some stupid thing like, oh, it's cold this winter, or, oh, I will, you know, there's...
There certainly have been a lot of monster attacks lately. It's so unsafe to travel outside of town.
Yeah, whereas, like, in this game, like, I walk up to a townsperson, and this is not a revelation for anyone who's been playing Western RPGs, but, like, I could get in an interesting conversation.
It's right.
Like, but on the other hand, I think there's probably going to be some cons, but I don't want to speak to concrete gameplay stuff until I will say that the menu system is like, what? For me at the moment.
That's a BioWare thing.
You know, like...
It's better than Mass Effects.
I just want to say that I think, you know, it's a pros and cons thing, but I'm digging it. I think the graphics are so-so based on what I've seen so far.
Aesthetically, right. It's kind of a disaster.
Which
it's not an attractive game.
360.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But I think that's another situation with a game that's been in development for 4, 5, 6 years, and they locked it down at some point.
Though they did a good job on this one, I think, in executing on the IP concept and sort of the comic book concept I was talking about broadly, in that, you know, first of all, it's Dragon Age Origins, which we know there's going to be more. Second of all, they pick something that's going to, you know, they not that you can, you know, do this, but they did definitely, I think, hedge their bets on picking something that has both broad potential for expansion and also, like, will be successful. Mm-hmm. And then stuff.
It's pretty homogenous.
They've got, you know, the novelizations are actually, or they're not novelizations, they're actually tied in novels written by the writer of the game. So it, like, expands the universe and that sort of broad, you know, universe thing. They're doing that lots of really
games well. Games as multimedia franchise.
They're doing really well with Dragon Age, I think, overall. And I really enjoyed the intro and, like, the I don't know. Is it spoilers to spoil the first 2 hours of the game? I guess a lot of people haven't played it yet.
I haven't played it at all.
I'm just saying.
And everyone's first 2 hours will be different depending on what their origin is.
One of six, right?
It's also an 80-hour game.
So what I'm saying basically is that, like, I got sucked into the drama. Let's put it like that. There's some bad shit that goes down in the beginning of the Human Noble Quest, and it's, you know, I got sucked in right away, and I enjoyed it. The thing about me is, I don't have a role-playing background. I never play, and when I mean that, I don't mean pen. I mean pen and paper.
Right.
Yeah. And
Same here.
When it comes to games that give you all these dialogue choices, I role-play as myself, which tends to confound the games because a lot of them are like, you know, like in KOTOR, it'll be like, "Help, my baby's lost," and it'll be like, "Yes, ma'am, I'll rescue your baby and bring him to you." You're like, "Yes, ma'am, I will go find your baby and fuck him till he explodes." You know, it's like
the games don't deal with shades of gray
at anymore. All. But like this one, it's like there's like sarcastic answers, which aren't really, you know, that's just being sarcastic is. And I found that when I was talking to different characters in this game, based on the way the character, my relationship with the character was how I was picking the choices, like. Talking to my dad, I was being more respectful, and my mom, you know, in the game. But then there's this one, like this, the captain or whatever he was, sort of the second in command of the Grey Wardens guy that I met, who was kind of like sarcastic. So I was picking the sarcastic choices back, and it was like, I don't know, it was like very fun. So that is my newbie sort of response to what I played so far. I'm digging it.
Was this drama like personal dramas, or is it more political tinged drama?
It's actually a nice blend of the personal and political. I think that what one of the things I don't like about fantasy, or when I don't like fantasy, is that I feel that the characters are ciphers and it's all about this giant epic overarching story. Like, I would argue that, yes, I mean, you know, Viggo Mortensen, whatever he was called.
Viggo Mortensen?
Is
Strider.
I believe that was Aragorn Ranger from the
him.
North.
Whatever. He is, like, a really cool character, but as far as, like, a character goes, he's not, like, a very well-developed character. He's, like, a cool guy.
Not in the movies.
There's, like, some stuff with sure.
You don't even learn that he's, like, 100 and over 100 years old until the second
movie. There's, like, some parts where he, like, kisses Liv Tyler or whatever, and then, you know.
Which didn't even happen. read the books. So.
Which is like the other 98% of his character is just like, I'm a dude with a sword, you know? It's like, and I find that fantasy, the problem is they usually, this, you know, the overarching, you know, like meta story that's very big and well-developed and is full of characters and is very elaborate and it's politically interesting, but there's not as much like personal character
development.
They deal
with archetypes too much.
Yeah, and so far it's been a compelling, you know, like I really like, there's a series of books by Stephen Brist. It's called Vlad Taltos novels. Mm-hmm. And that's a fantasy novel series I really like. It's not as popular as like, you know, like Robert Jordan or whatever, but it's like very personally like, you know, tinged fantasy novels. It's in a fantasy universe. It's not that different from other fantasy universes, but it's like very, very personal and witty and fun. That's what I go for. I mean, again, I think it's sort of the same way I feel about Star Wars is like, well, I don't like Star Wars. I feel it's like sort of that big, you know, like light and dark, like struggle. The characters aren't super, to me, compelling.
Yeah. See,
but like, you know, Star Trek, again, God, this is nerdy, is like very character driven.
Well, I think we're going to have to say goodbye to Alice. It's getting late. Aww. So thank you for hanging in
so
as long
hard
as you did.
To say goodbye to Alice Liang.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, you're talking about Star Wars and light and dark, and that doesn't necessarily work for you.
I am aware it's popular.
I'm a fan of the Star Wars like movies, specifically like Star Wars: Empire and Return of the Jedi, much more so
the real
than,
ones,
much more so than the prequel trilogy. And one thing I actually forgot to mention last week was that I went over to LucasArts to check out the Old Republic. I got a chance to check it out.
Oh, sweet! Well, so let's BioWare. Perfect segue.
Yes,
and double segue.
There were two
combo
parts,
bonus.
There were two parts to the visit. One of which I can't talk about quite yet. The embargo's not up. One thing I can talk about is they've been announcing different classes along the way, and one of the classes that they recently announced is the Imperial Agent. And I actually got to see them like give a demo. They weren't doing hands-on with the Imperial Agent, so I didn't actually get to play the character, but I did get a chance to see them playing it and talk about what they're kind of trying to do with this character class. And one of the things that they claim they're trying to stress is that they're not trying to play into the traditional MMO archetype of tank, rogue,
the triangle, the Holy Trinity.
They want to create characters that make sense within the fiction and the world they exist, but that can fill multiple roles, you know, within that. And obviously they're going to be going into even more detail on that in the coming weeks and months and how that's actually going to play out once they announce all the characters. But this Imperial Agent, the level they showed, it which looked like it was designed just to show off the character and what it can do. You're on the factory on Nalhata, if you care about the fiction and all that stuff. I admit I do. So like,
that's cool. Where the huts are from.
This
right?
is funny. Yes. This is like,
why do I know this? I know. It's like it's like secret knowledge. You're ashamed. You know.
Somehow I've taken control and made it like hard, like you're like ashamed of liking Star Wars in this conversation.
I've always been ashamed of liking Star Wars. I've never owned.
Which is
a
where
Star Wars.
Like I'm like such an anomaly, particularly in the game industry, being someone who doesn't like Star Wars.
I see. I've never owned a Star Wars T-shirt. Never. Would wear one in public, but have gone to see every Star Wars opening at midnight, and of course made fun of the one guy that
Shane
dressed up in
Bettenhausen
Jedi.
Dragged me to Rose. Toys R Us at midnight to buy Episode One toys, so I deserve Star Wars.
I was gonna say Shane dressed up as Jar Jar Binks a couple years ago for Halloween. So
Shane actually likes Jar Jar Binks.
He does.
That says everything.
He's a well written character. So. Yeah, but anyway, this level in Nahata, basically you have a gauntlet of the Imperial Agent is primarily a stealth agent. What they were showing definitely seemed, even though they say they're not going for this kind of archetype, it definitely seemed very much a rogue-like character. That it's all about stealth and subterfuge to try to get through it. One of the things this character has is actually the ability to actually take cover and use cover in combat, which I think is somewhat unique in kind of the MMO space.
Yeah, actually, they're kind of giving you sort of balanced classes with Alliance and Empire because or whatever they're calling it, you know, 20,000 years
ago. Empire and Old Republic.
Yeah, because they showed off the smuggler class at PAX, and it also it kind of works along the same lines. Although I think the smuggler, you're supposed to be like working on your charisma more than stealth. But you have the cover element.
Right, and when, in addition to that, you have like these different types of probes and things you can shoot out. They showed an exploding probe that when you shoot the target, whenever the target takes image or takes damage at first, it causes the probe to blow up and causes like cascading damage to multiple. The other thing that they showed off was a sleep dart. You can put people to sleep and help to sneak past them. And the interesting thing is you actually did, there was stealth elements to it where they'd be on patrol and you'd have to kind of sneak around. You could sneak up behind them. One of the things the character has is an ability called Shiv. So you actually just sneak up behind them and stab them in the back and they're dead.
And that's very rogue.
Yeah.
Stab them with your makeshift knife.
Super
or
rogue.
Shiv.
I really hope they keep that name Shiv in there because I appreciate it. I'm sure they'll come up with some reason it's called Shiv or something.
It'll be called
it.
Like a vibro Shiv.
But part of this was that they actually have a stealth belt, which allows you to be invisible for short periods of time, and you kind of walk like Sam Fisher sneaking around.
I really feel like that with this game, WoW, and not to belittle it, was certainly a game in the heritage of where the genre had already been. It's just a very, 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 very effective execution of what the genre had done. I'm hoping that, you know what people are realizing now is that WoW is sort of like the Bed Bath & Beyond of MMOs. It's a category killer.
Right.
So if you're going to do something else, you better do some. You know, if you're going to try to do a massive, big-scale, full-scale production, $30 million game, it's got to be something different.
I mean, one of the things that they've shown and talked
about.
Well, one of the things they've shown and talked about is the whole conversation system and making it so that you, at least on the surface, give a shit about the quest you're on and what you're doing. And, you know, I'll be able to talk about it more in detail in a couple of weeks, but. Yeah, while you're playing it, it feels like you're playing a legitimate single player RPG.
Feels like you're playing a BioWare game.
But you can also interact and bring other people into that world.
That's the hook for the game, is that it's not so much an MMO as it is like a massively persistent single player RPG with the hooks for co-op and multiplayer.
Well, I mean, they were saying all the right things at E3 where the famous quote, at least among us internally, is, yeah, we could have played KOTOR 3, but we decided we'd make KOTOR 3 through 7 in one go and make it an MMO that you can experience that way as well. And that's what they claim is how they're approaching the game. And certainly I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt.
I've made a big caricaturish deal out of my dislike of Star Wars, which is real. But I mean, I am always up for seeing how people push the art of making games forward. So that I'm totally. And hey, if Dragon Age turns me into a complete BioWare fanboy, the possibility space is there. So,
I think at the very least, you should check out Mass
Effect.
Because
I did play some KOTOR, and I will say that it even though it was still black white, it did lack the sort of some of the silliness of Star Wars that it had more drama to it.
What do you think about Star Trek Online?
I don't know. I really don't know because
I have to say what I've seen of it actually has kind of impressed me.
Like, I'm all super jazzed after, like many people, I think, after the new movie. I've always loved Star Trek.
You just picked up the Blu-ray, right?
And I wonder if they're going to be burning any bridges by the fact that the MMO exists outside of the continuity of the movie. It's, the original Star Trek continuity that's existed for 40-odd years and has been kind of made obsolete by the new movie. Like, I wonder if people are going to be going into it expecting, oh, cool, it's going to be like Spock and Kirk, and no, actually it's about like some obscure war with the Klingons in the far-flung future.
Well, isn't that what I mean? But you look at it, like, isn't that what the Old Republic is? Some obscure war in the far-flung past?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
it's all
point.
About execution. Yeah. And
I suppose, but I don't know. I feel like Star Trek doesn't have, I mean, even though it's been around longer, I don't feel like Star Trek has quite the same
mythos?
Cultural traction as
Well, I mean, they certainly don't have, not to use a too geeky of a term, but they certainly don't have the expanded universe that Star Wars has and has been able to cultivate over comics,
just have
books.
And they've stumbled over that, too, like Enterprise, that god-awful fucking series that
with,
a few years ago.
Jeremy loves the opening song to Enterprise. Be careful how you talk about it.
It has been a long time getting from there to here.
But, fuck me. But they tried it with each other, like, hey, let's just stick this crap in between what we know and what we know. We'll just like shoehorn something in, and it's like, but it can really stumble.
Yeah,
just because they
I don't know
successfully rebooted Star Trek this time.
I don't know from a story standpoint if it's gonna be interesting or anything like that, but the stuff I've seen, whether it's a ship combat, definitely like impressed me, but also the away team stuff actually looked like they really are trying to make Mass Effect in a lot of ways, it's the MMO. Which is, it's interesting.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I said as much on a different podcast. You weren't even there, so like you came to this conclusion independently of me.
Well, I saw
so
it at PAX.
It's pretty obvious.
That's Mass Effect. It also looked good. It didn't, or at least it looked like it could be good. And they just announced today, I should have thrown it as like a quick hit in the news story, they're going to be doing an open beta in January.
I do feel like Star Trek Online is a much more traditional approach to the MMO. Yeah. I mean,
well,
like
they have a starship.
But they are doing it
in interesting ways where your skills and abilities are actually based on your crew composition,
right.
which I think is actually kind of interesting, potentially. So I think
there's a lot of potential there, but I do feel like Star Wars is more of a
Clearly the Old Republic
more
is
more of a forward thinking kind of approach,
and clearly BioWare with the kind of KOTOR goodwill that still exists for BioWare-made KOTOR games is the 800-pound gorilla in this.
Yeah, I mean, outside of people who read the Expanded Universe novels, I think that KOTOR was kind of people's first sort of wake-up call to the fact that, like, there's more to Star Wars than the films in a lot of way. You know, there's a lot of people who read those novels, but you know what I mean? People, like, that possibility space was established, you know, to mm-hmm. a large extent by KOTOR, right, and through its quality.
Well, what's interesting is, I mean, the Expanded Universe stuff, it started with some books, but in the comics realm, it actually started with Knights of the Republic. Knights of the Republic was a Dark Horse title for a long time, and it's all born out of that. So,
okay.
Huh. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it all started. So
I guess the point is, you know, so Star Trek would have the potential if they just do it right. So just do it right, guys. It's all you got
to
do.
I mean, they both obviously hold a lot of potential. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if either of them. I just want them to have enough say. Like, I don't even care about the can it dethrone WoW. No, the answer is no. No one's dethroning WoW at this point in time. But can it exist
concurrently and build its own?
So it's financially viable, so it can continue to exist and continue to kind of.
Well, the problem is about, you know. Is people going and making, like, that game's popular. I'll make a game the people who like that game will want to play, and that is when they get shot in the face. It's
right.
Like, I'll make a game that's, like, even, you know, got, like, an overlap. Like, obviously there's an overlap, right,
yeah.
of these audiences. But there's probably enough people who care passionately about this and this approach also
mm-hmm.
that – the approach is very different, and the license creates, you know, potential. So that's you know, obviously we're seeing that a lot. It's like I have this personal feeling that it's pointless for most developers to make a shooter this generation. The genre is just too locked down by the top tier titles, right? So why would you try to make a game?
Well, I mean, Uncharted would tend to argue otherwise. I mean, that
was a
new IP.
Well, no, but they go outside. They go outside.
Yeah, it's not a standard first person shooter.
No, I guess that's true. I mean, okay, I agree with you.
And it's also about, like I was saying, you know, the expanding the possibility. Like, Uncharted brings something different to the table.
Yeah,
but if you,
the way it tells
stories,
specifically.
I mean, if you look at all the B shooters that just, like, sank like a stone this mm-hmm. generation,
yeah.
it's like...
Well, I mean, that's been happening since, I don't know, since the shooter took off on PC.
Yeah, but
yeah.
this time they cost $20 million to make, and
there's
then
that.
You're going to sink your company.
Well, I mean, something else I've been playing that probably cost at least $20 million to make was Assassin's Creed 2, which...
but it actually feels like they got their money's worth.
I talked about it, you know, a few, like, probably a month and a half ago at this point, after I went and played it at the preview event in Italy, and this is my first time actually playing the retail game. I went out and bought it on Tuesday, and God, it is killing me because I'm working on 2 hours of sleep and coming into the office because this game has totally and completely taken over my life when I'm not here in the office.
Huh.
I'm probably about 5 hours into it so far, and...
So you're kind of recovering the same ground you did at the preview event.
Except, no, I'm able to go through it much, much, much faster than I did at the preview event.
On top of that, I mean, once you get past, like, the first maybe 2 hours or so, the game is pretty much
right.
Play it however you want.
But the interesting thing is what I'm able to do now is at the preview event, you only have a certain amount of time to play it. So I was really focusing on, like, the main story. And what I found is I wasn't expecting this. I was expecting to still kind of mainline the story, but I find that every time I show up in an area, I go to every vantage point that appears on my mm-hmm. map before I do anything else.
Yeah, that's always my approach
but
to playing.
But the first game, I didn't care about that. I cared for, like, the first hour or two, but then I just stopped caring when I realized it didn't ultimately mean much of anything other than allowing me to get to other parts of the city. But this time around,
it's really advantageous here because
the codex pages.
Well, not only that, yeah, like you get the map opened up. You get the map opened up by using a vantage point. And it makes the gameplay much easier because you have a map all of a sudden that's filled out, so you can tell where enemy patrols are. You get a sense of geography.
Yeah.
But it also does show you where all the secrets are, and you need to know those by the end of the game.
The bizarre thing is, for Florence, I do have to say, I did recognize my way around the city from when I was actually there.
Nice.
Because all the landmarks, I mean, obviously outside the Il Duomo, you don't have the Baptistry
in front of it.
So there are some very major differences.
So I haven't actually been to Italy myself.
Yeah.
But
it's bigger. I mean, Florence is bigger.
Well, sure. But you know, I was playing through the game to review it. So obviously I was playing before there were any guides or facts or anything out for it. And there was one secret I was missing. I needed to get one of the last glyphs in the game.
Uh-huh.
And like it shows you an image in your menu screen of what the building looks like, but it doesn't show you where that is.
Does it tell you what it is?
But it tells you what it is.
Which is
it? So I went, I don't remember, but I went to Google Maps.
Oh.
It was someplace in Venice. Or yeah, Venice. And I checked in Google Maps, like, because they're all landmarks that still exist now.
Right.
And looked it up. And it gave me, you know, like a Google map of
Rough
Venice
area.
And showed me exactly where it was going to be in relation to like the piazza. There it was. I mean, that
and
that
you
was,
found it through.
Yeah, I Googled my way.
That's beautiful.
Like Google mapped my way through Assassin's Creed 2 to find the last secret that I needed.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's they did a great job of you know, like going a step beyond something like Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
And replicating the layout of the city.
For me, from like the way the story is told and everything, one of the reasons I think it works as well as it does is the fact that in a lot of ways the games, it deals with some very like, you know, tragic events early on, but it also doesn't take itself very seriously.
That's one way to put it.
at all, which I appreciate. And if you have even – I would recommend if you're going to play this game, you don't have to play it in Italian. I think you can play it just fine with English actors. And
half the English dialogue is Italian anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But it does help if you have a passing understanding of Italian curse words and insults because you really can appreciate that stuff a little bit more.
I bet Sterling's enjoying it.
Oh, yeah. Sterling's been having a good time with it. But, yeah, I've just gotten to the point where I'm a little further than I was when I was playing it at the preview event. So everything's kind of new to me at this point up until I get to Venice. But I don't have much else to say other than I'm having a great time with it.
Yeah, I feel like I've said so much about the game already. I don't have anything really left to say. It's just an improvement over the original in every imaginable way.
I've done a few, like the first few Assassin Tomb things, like new ones that I hadn't done before, and those completely change the game in that it's a completely different experience. It's almost a puzzle environment of figuring how to get to where I need to get versus when you're in the overworld where you can kind of get anywhere you want to be.
Yeah, those have received such universal praise that I bet Assassin's Creed 3 is going to be packed with them. I bet there's going to be a ton of them.
Well, it's interesting. It's almost like that core, even though that portion of the game wasn't made by EA Montreal, it was made in EA Shanghai.
You mean Ubisoft?
Ubisoft. Yeah. Sorry, we've been talking about EA so much.
Yeah. But also you can say EA Montreal. You know?
Yeah. Yeah,
exists,
so. But you know, that core group of guys at EA Montreal are the ones that made Sands of Time, and I think in a lot of ways they go back to that kind of design element in the world and how it's made up.
But you know, one of my favorite things about Assassin's Creed 2 is that it kind of reverses the direction that the Prince of Persia games took, because in the Prince of Persia Sands of Time, you had a hero who was like this totally likable, cheeky, good-natured guy, and in the second game, Warrior Within, he was this same character, but just a complete surly asshole that no one liked. So brooding, and everywhere he goes, there's heavy metal playing. And here in Assassin's Creed 2, the first game, you kind of have that warrior within Prince as Altair. Like, he had no personality.
But
he was
Desmond was the personality in a lot of ways.
But, I mean, Altair was the person you played as through most of the game, even if it was virtual.
Right.
And he didn't really have a personality to speak of. He was, you know, an assassin who existed to kill people.
Well, he also never took his hood off. And the fact that you're introduced to Ezio without any of those.
Right. Ezio is more like going from the warrior within to Sands of Time.
Yeah,
like
I think
the difference between the two characters.
Ubisoft has
great.
Certainly had a struggle, I think, with creating, like, this has kind of been a recurring theme with them, is that this line of creating main characters that people actually like, because
they hit it with Ezio. He's really
because they've
really
gotten a
likeable
lot of criticism
character
over the years, yes and no's about like
people still like Sam Fisher.
No, I'm not saying that they're bad at it. I'm just saying, you know, they've gone back
and
forth.
I kind of don't like him in what I've seen of Splinter Cell 5, or whatever it's called.
Convicted.
I think it'll be very interesting to see what they do in that game when it actually releases. It's very soon.
So Christian, are you planning to play Assassin's Creed 2?
Well, that's the funny thing is I didn't play the original.
I missed it.
But
skip
then
it and go
no, I reached.
Two.
I reached the conclusion after missing the first one that I didn't need to play, and that was something I reached the conclusion a while ago. It's on my list. We'll see if I get to it.
The amazing thing for this game is.
I ask because the meta plot, the overarching story, I'm really curious to hear your take on it. As someone who plays a lot of Japanese RPGs, as someone who likes Evangelion, I would really be curious to see what you think of the overall story arc of Assassin's Creed 2, because the ending of the game,
it's a mind fuck.
I
wouldn't say that. It's kind of I mean, it does some things that I think Japanese RPGs have been kind of flirting with for a very long time, and This game just kind of comes out and does it.
I definitely want to. I want to give it a shot. It is a very long game. I went through, you know, just personally, I went through a period of a lot of travel and stuff recently, and I came out the other end of it finally with my sort of enthusiasm for games is kind of is ramped up compared to where it's been this year, which has been kind of low. So now I'm starting to really.
I kind of took like a year and a half off of really playing anything except portable games, and lately I've been playing more console games, and I'm like,
I have to say, for me,
these are really fun.
Like so far, and I'm not one to get into the whole game of the year debate all that much, but for me, like Assassin's is right up there with Batman with the games I've had the most fun playing so far this year.
We kind of play as the same character in both.
Yeah, I mean, you are
Ezio.
Ezio Wayne,
Renaissance Batman.
Batman. That sounds hot. No, really. Seriously, it doesn't sound great.
Seriously, I almost wrote in my review, like, if it weren't for Arkham Asylum saying, hey, this people can Batman. Actually make a great Batman game, this would be the best Batman game ever.
One of the things I really do appreciate the little details. Like, when you've been running and you have this kind of shoulder cape your character has, and it gets thrown off to the side. But if you're just walking along normally, after about 6 or 7 steps, your guy would shrug his shoulder and just knock it back off to go a little more casual. It's like little details like that. Most people don't really care about, and I wouldn't care about most ways, but that one time it does catch you, and it just totally helps to suck you into this world, into this character, and helps you to learn a little bit more. You learn basically in some ways that Ezio is still a vain man in a lot of ways. He likes being dressed up as a dandy, as he killing guys and being, you know, showered in blood. And I think that's interesting.
If you compare his character model to Altair's, he's like so – he just has all these layers of clothing, and like as you go through the game and get more and more armor options, like they become more and more regal. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, I think the art of creating a really polished game is in the detail, but the struggle for game developers is always to, like, what details matter, right?
Absolutely.
And if they nailed it, then they did a really
good
job.
First time he's putting on that the kind of outfit that stylistically is very different, but it from almost like a fashion archetype, it looks like the same outfit you're wearing in the first Assassin's Creed in like color and composition.
Right.
And like when you're first putting on, it's like close up, tight shots on every part of the outfit, and you realize how much. I can only imagine how many iterations they went through creating this entire outfit that you wear for the majority of the game, and they definitely, those guys knocked it out of the park for me.
All right.
So, anything? What else are you guys, Jeremy? What are you
playing? I mean, so immersed in Assassin's Creed 2 that I haven't had much time to do much of anything else. I started working on Spirit Tracks, and I can't really talk about that yet. That'll have to be for next week.
Right.
I'm playing Mario, I'm sure you covered Mario off.
Have you been playing a lot of co-op or just single player?
No co-op yet.
Because last Saturday I actually got together with a bunch of friends of mine, and we had a Super Mario barbecue where we did a little cookout and then all sat down and played co-op. And we actually played from World 1-1 all the way to 6-3 in one sitting.
Nice.
Which is not nearly as impressive as some people. I think Cody on the 1UP boards, he got from 0 to 100% of everything in the game in one day.
I know someone who played it for 20 hours straight and got 5 stars on his menu screen. Like,
holy
that means
crap.
His save file had complete
everything.
Completion.
Wow.
In like a day.
Wow.
I
People
definitely want to pull together. I mean,
it's a lot of fun co-op.
It brings back, you know, I was very skeptical of online gaming, and I resisted it really heavily, and I still do. I'm sort of being dragged slowly, kicking and screaming into it when I realize the advantages, like a dumb fuck, slowly. But you know, I miss the old days of when I used to get together with my friends, particularly and play Bomberman, and I think this is kind of like this. This is going to bring that back, and I can. Fortunately for me, I can actually bring together some of the same friends that I played, you know, Super Nintendo Bomberman with, and sort of. I think that, I can't wait to do that. Actually,
yeah, I mean, everyone who's touched the game that I know has just loved it, whether they're serious video game fans or not. Like I got my my own retail copy of it earlier this week. I bought that, and then realized I'm not going to have time to play it this week, so I lent it to my fiance's cousin and her fiance, and she texted me today to tell me, we had so much fun playing Mario that, my fiance is going to Toys R Us, and he's going to use a gift certificate for our upcoming baby to buy a copy of Mario. Like, they're having a kid in a month, and they're going to use some of their kid's money to buy Mario.
I hope you don't need a car seat, kid. Yeah. Just hang on tight.
I feel a little guilty about that. Like, you know, maybe Uncle Jeremy needs to do something nice for you to make
but
up
I'm sure
for
eventually the kid will still – they'll still be playing that system.
Right, exactly. I mean, I've done the kid a favor because –
Given a good foundation,
play Mario with him.
Yeah,
and that's awesome.
Yeah. So, anything else?
Yeah, I mean, all I've really done lately, I've been catching up with some previews, and most of those I've talked about on other podcasts,
right.
Especially ATB.
Which, by the way, congratulations. Like, you guys have been doing a good job, and yeah, obviously the reception to that. If any of our listeners hasn't been listening, that's our new RPG-focused podcast Jeremy has been doing, and
Time babble.
Yes. I've got to congratulate you on that name.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, all you have to do to come up with a good name, as Jeremy and so many other people have proven, is just give your audience the option to name it, and inevitably you'll come up with a name. Then you just say,
be like, "Oh, sorry, I'm a jerk." That's okay. I can cop to being a jerk. It's cool. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess the only other thing I've been playing besides Assassin's Creed and Spirit Tracks. I did a hands-on preview of Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey, which I mentioned a while back. I got to play a little bit of the English version of that when Atlas was in town last week. And that got me in the mood to go back and finally finish Etrian Odyssey 2 from last year, because I made it to like the second major boss, and it just completely annihilated me. So I went back to the beginning, like went back to my save file, went back to the lowest level of the dungeon and worked my way up and finally beat that boss that had daunted me before.
I remember that became a weekly discussion in our edit meetings. Everyone asked Jeremy Etrian Odyssey, and nope, it's too fucking hard.
Yeah, it's quite a game. Yeah.
Strange Journey's not that hard, is it? Or is it it's hard, right?
Yeah, it's a different kind of hard.
Because I'm really looking forward to
Etrian Odyssey. Like, the idea is that you go into the dungeon and you just push yourself as hard as you can to explore as much of it as possible without dying, and then you warp back to town. Save your progress, go again. Whereas Megaten, it's more about, well, Nick Maragos, who localized it, described it to me as being more about surviving each battle, because each battle can be really, really hard. And then between battles, there's a lot more leniency within the dungeons.
Safety,
there's save points. It's easier to restore your health and so forth.
Yeah, that's the truth. That is definitely the thing about SMT, and that's been going on for years, is that you can actually just get in the wrong side of a battle, and if you don't do it right, you just...
Yeah, I mean, that was something I really appreciated about Persona, the remake, which I played Persona for the first time on PSP, and there were like some battles where it seemed like I was completely doomed, and then I realized, oh wait, no, I have these other options. I can try parlaying, or hey, wait a minute, I already have one of these demons that's trying to kill me. I've already, you know, talked to one of them, and I have their soul or whatever. So I can show that to them, and then they'll go away. And even though I have like one character left with 5 hit points, I can win this battle because, you know, I can use other options besides fighting. On the other hand, you know, you can also totally screw yourself over by trying to parlay with someone, and they decide they don't like you, and then they attack double ferocity or whatever. So, yeah, it has that kind of that conversational dynamism to it.
I'm really slowing down on DS, by which I mean, not really playing it much at all anymore, but I am... looking forward to that.
No, Strange Journey. I'm really going to be pushing the game because I think I've said elsewhere that it's an RPG that you would expect to find on a console, just in terms of its scope and its challenge, the tone of it. It's much more mature.
Yeah, I love the fact that it's just really frustrating to me, and it has been for a long time with a lot of Japanese RPGs, is that the main characters continue to be, you know, younger.
That's,
and
that's not the case here. I mean, you're playing like a scientific UN exploration team, and you're all adults. It's multicultural. You know, it's much more.
Yeah, it looks like this. You know,
it's much more like hard sci-fi until you actually get into the dungeon that you're exploring, and it goes from being sci-fi to like demon fantasy. But it's kind of a gradual transition, and so like the first dungeon, you know, you're in the Antarctic, so it's like an icy cavern. But the second level of the dungeon, it's like you're in a World War II village that's been bombed out, and it's burning, and there's planes flying overhead, even though you're deep below the polar ice. So it kind of gets into like this otherworldly bizarreness,
kind of lost world kind of.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the Savage Land or something.
Right. Yeah.
It's pretty crazy, but like it's not the kind of RPG experience you would expect to have on DS, and it's the kind of RPG experience that a lot of RPG fans are like, why doesn't anyone ever make RPGs like this anymore? Well, there it is, and everything I've played of it has been really, really satisfying, and I'm really looking forward to it.
I mean, seeing as it's made for the DS, is it one of those things that you can play for like 5-10 minutes at a stretch, still have fun, or does it require
it's not
20,
like a
30,
mini game
40
kind
minutes
of game, but yeah it's more about dungeon diving. Mm-hmm. So you want to play it in longer periods of time, but I mean,
yeah,
30 minutes at a time is not a big deal, and anytime you want to, you know, stop playing, you just close the lid and it's fine. Whereas, you know, like Persona 3 or something, people complain because you have to play sometimes like 3 hours at a stretch before you get to a save point, and that's
right.
that's really tiring. So this has the convenience of a portable system, but more of the substance and depth of a console RPG.
Cool.
Of course, it has, you know, like, you know, lower level graphics.
Save anywhere. Japan needs to learn about save anywhere. Get the fuck over yourselves. Even Mario is like, has it couched in that term of like quick save, like I mean, it doesn't have any effective difference.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's like, why do they have this mental fucking barrier?
Right, and then when you beat the game. Spoiler, you get the ability to save anywhere you want.
No, it's not a spoiler.
It's not a spoiler.
It tells you that, like in World 1 or something.
Yeah.
Or like, in the manual. It was in the manual.
Okay, yeah. So it's really weird. You have to like earn the ability to save anywhere.
It's just
kind of strange.
It's one of things people cling to. I don't get it.
Well, I think obviously that's definitely the question why, and we've been talking about that plenty over the podcast. And so I guess why save anywhere? So,
or why not?
What? Good question.
Why not save anywhere?
Christian, thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Jeremy, thank always you. A pleasure as always. And
word.
Alice, even though she's not here, thanks to her as well. Next week's show, we will have a show for Thanksgiving. Have something.
We're not recording that on Thursday.
No.
You're about to become my unfavorite person.
No. We're going to record earlier in the weekend. I have some interesting thoughts on what I kind of want to do with the show next week, and I hope you guys enjoy it. We do have some very, very cool guests lined up throughout the rest of December, so don't have them necessarily locked down to the point where we can say who we're going to have on, but definitely some big names in the industry that hopefully will offer some interesting insight into it. So until then, we'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.